Okay, I'm gonna check the participants list here to make sure that we have Commissioner Kehoe on. I did hear Commissioner Graybill's name. Is Commissioner Kehoe with us?
I'm here, thank you.
Okay. Well, let's go ahead and bring to this meeting to order. This is the meeting of the Columbia River Work Group on July 21st. And you'll see on the screen here that we have our agenda topics. The first thing is opening remarks. Are there any opening remarks from either of the other work group members? Okay.
Done here, Don.
Okay. Commissioner Graybill, are you okay with moving forward?
Yeah, let's proceed. Thank you.
Okay. Oh, and one other attendance matter. We do have, this is an open meeting, so we got members of the public present, and that also is an opportunity for non-committee members that are commission members to be in attendance as well. And maybe it might be good, Nikki, if you could tell us if there are some other commissioners in attendance and who they might be.
Right now we've got Jim and Molly. I haven't seen Larry yet.
Okay, very good, thanks. Well, let's go ahead and move through the agenda then. In terms of a meeting purpose, the commission agenda on July 31st is listed to consider public comment on the public review draft that was released in early June and scheduled for, and to determine a schedule for a final decision. So as with all commission committee meetings, the Columbia Work Group is held to allow for more in-depth discussion of issues than time is normally allotted to on the full commission agenda and make any appropriate recommendations. I think the biggest thing that's here is that we've had a public review draft over the summer for the public to comment on. And if there's anything really, the biggest thing that could come out of that public comment process would be if we've missed something big that was not considered. There could be some lower level good ideas that should be added or even lower level suggestions for language changes. So it's really a question for the committee here when we go over the public comment. Is there anything from this last public review comment period that the work group believes is significant enough to bring to the attention of the full commission? And then there's the matter of scheduling final action, too, that the commission has to take up. So let me, toward this end, let me just move through the agenda then. We have a public comment period that starts with a review of the written public comments that were received at or since the June 11th meeting over the course of the summer. We've got an open public comment opportunity for those that are on the webinar. We have a section here on commissioner questions of a factual or a scientific or legal matter. We did not want to get into debating opinions there was some concern about at our June commission meeting, but we did give the commissioners the opportunity to ask any questions of a factual nature on a scientific fish type thing. And I think there's three questions that have come forward from commissioners that the staff is ready to answer. There's a couple of questions for our legal counsel one that came up just before our last meeting from a Mr. Brian McLaughlin about some legal language on the purpose statement language. And then there was one other legal question that Commissioner Kehoe brought forward. So when we get to agenda item number three, we could anticipate that. We've got an agenda item called other considerations. If anyone has anything that they want to bring up then, or if something comes up in public testimony that the work group ought to deal with. Future process and schedule has always been on our agenda, and so that would again be relative to any future process at the commission table or at the work group level. Number six, any recommendations that the committee might feel are appropriate for the full commission to hear. And number seven is any conclusionary matters, if there are any staff assignments or any closing remarks. So that's the agenda that is out there as a draft. Are there any objections to moving forward with this as our working agenda for the meeting?
No objections here, Mr. Chair.
None here.
Okay, good. Well, then let's go ahead and proceed. When we focus on public comment just for the period since our last meeting or anything that was hanging around at the time of our last meeting, we've got quite a bit of written public comment that each of the work group members has been able to see on the website. Let me see if I can focus on this and maybe ask Ryan Lothrop to offer any opening remarks he might have on this. So as we look through the website where the Columbia River Fishery Policy Review Process materials are all collected, we all know that at the bottom, the staff has done a very nice job of collecting all the public comments here by period. So before we try to work our way through that, again, with the idea of discussing at the committee level, at the work group level, if there's anything that is worth more of an in-depth discussion, particularly if there's some new ideas, new concepts, or suggestions for language changes, that would be appropriate. Ryan, is there anything you'd like to say about having collected all this? And let me say thanks again to you and all the staff that have done such a nice job doing this.
Good morning, Chair and Commissioners. Hope you're having a good morning. Well, going back in time, this tool was created during the PRC process to submit comments directly to work group commissioners or PRC commissioners. We kept the tool alive as the PRC was suspended and converted, and then the Washington Commission created the work group. So we've been compiling comments, both received directly to the commission and via electronic submission, as well as what's submitted on this website. And so we've posted these on the website based on sort of timing of upcoming meetings, but also quantity of comments received. So we kind of use those as our framework to decide when it was appropriate to post comments. I guess more specifically, the last work group occurred on, I believe, June 20th. And so basically the last three bullet points there of comments received would encompass the previous work group meeting through today. We did post late last week due to some new comments coming in that were worth getting out there for public and work group commissioner consumption. But also we also wanted to make sure we got the latest and greatest, but we had to put a cutoff at some point to post. So we chose noon yesterday. What I can also speak to is we do anticipate providing a little more in-depth presentation on these comments during between the two work group meetings received at the upcoming commission meeting. Just kind of rough sketch, we probably have about 600 to 700 comments received. But again, we're looking at the comments pertaining to the policy or the work group recommendation, as well as during the time frame from when the work group developed the recommendation on June 20th. And so we're going to, for evaluation for upcoming commission, kind of make the cutoff at noon today so we can have time to turn around a staff presentation. So if there's any questions, I can answer that, but that's the basic concept of these comments.
Okay.
This is Dave Grayville. Ryan, I know I've asked for before, you know, it's not unusual for when we receive or review at the commission level an issue that generated significant public comment, or if it, I shouldn't say significant, but allowed for public comment, we usually get a synopsis that says this is how many were for, this is how many were against. And I believe you said that before, you know, there were probably a couple thousand at that point earlier, but would it be possible to categorize and provide some sort of synopsis of public comment from just this last period? And I understand they fall under different categories, but if there's some way to represent the public comment in a form that we could review.
So, Commissioner Graybill, you're spot on. That's actually our intent at the upcoming commission meeting at the end of the month. That's part of the staff presentation, the kind of categorizing by topic and the for or against. So that's what you should anticipate at the next commission meeting. Obviously, there's overlap on what people comment, but we're doing our best to take their comments and categorize as we've done in past other policy or rule processes with the commission.
Excellent. Thank you, Ryan.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, with regard to how to proceed through these, with regard to our agenda today, you know, I guess we could go batch by batch, or we could rely on the fact that the commissioners have read through all of these different batches and read all the various email traffic as it's come through or as it's been presented. And so I know I have looked at every one of the matters in this collection here, and we maybe have received a few others on the side too. So let me suggest that we do start back here on the June 2nd to June 10th one with that one letter that came in from Mr. Brian McLaughlin, who had some legal, had some questions about, well, a legal perspective, I guess I should say, relative to the RCW mandate and the language and the purpose statement. I think it'd be good to leave that to the side until we hear from our attorney under agenda item number 3. But there were some other things in that letter, and I know that at our last meeting, Commissioner Graybill, you were one who said, well, I'd like to not try to react to that letter right now, but let's sleep on it and talk about it a little bit more at our next meeting, which is now. I've also thought about it a little bit, but why don't we start with that one and then either move through these in batches or pick out some that any work group member feels warrants some further discussion. For example, we have 3 very similar letters, but serious letters from county commissioners on the east side. I think that would warrant some discussion. And there's been quite a few topics that have come up in all the letters, and we could think about talking about those. But why don't we start with on June 10th here. Let's see. Yeah, here's the one right off the bat. So if you recall this letter from Mr. McLaughlin about this, and again, the legal aspects of the purpose statement, let's set that aside. But is there any other discussion from the commissioners on any of the other matters that were postponed from our last meeting on this particular written communique?
Nothing here, Don.
Commissioner Graybill, on reflection, anything from you?
Well, I'm anxious to get into the discussion about what in the letter pertains to statute that came up and get Joe's perspective on that.
Okay. Well, we'll wait. I do have the RCW ready to put up when we get to that. But one other matter that was brought up in the letter had to do with the base period. And let's see if I can find that spot in his letter here. If I can find it, I can try to characterize it, but I might get it wrong. Well, perhaps it was in his oral testimony. Anyway, it had to do with the base period in the draft out for public review, the base period saying that we'll take something along the lines of the policy will try to address all these matters in relation to the three-year base period before the policy was set. And the questioning was, why pick that base period as opposed to picking a different base period in the middle of the five-year policy perspective? And I know this came up during the PRC meetings, and so let me repeat what I recall hearing during that process. And if there's a little bit more here, I guess it's my personal perspective about why that base period makes sense. So the policy in 2013 tried to do some new things. It was a pretty strong initiative, really, to do something quite different. And that was to reallocate the impacts more to the recreational fishery. And in the purpose statement, try to maintain the economic well-being and stability of the fishing industry, and had a lot of measures for the commercial fishery that were designed to try to actually enhance the economic viability. That was the target, according to all the analysis that was done at the time that the commission adopted it in 2013. And there was a set of economic estimates that showed things were going to get better for the commercial fishery. This was going to be done by more off-channel fisheries that had a strong yield. It was going to rely on moving to alternative gear that would allow...
Excuse me, Don. Are we talking about the base period, if it was appropriate? I don't think we need to review the document. I believe you're trying to address the question of the appropriate base period. And yeah. If you could address that specifically rather than reviewing the policy.
Well, that's what I'm trying to do here, Commissioner Graybill. Just give me just a moment. The objective was to increase. And so the five-year time period that we evaluated was supposed to achieve that objective. And since it did not, and in the adaptive management section, it says, if you do not have a greater catch in the off-channel areas, if you do not get selective fisheries in the commercial sector that catch more hatchery fish, and if you do not improve the economics, then you should go back and try to figure out what went wrong and try to get there. And so get there compared to what? To get there compared to where you were in 2016 in the middle of something that really wasn't quite working out, or to get there in some other period. So in the PRC process, the base period to judge whether the policy was performing or not was the 3 years prior. I'm comfortable with those 3 years prior. And it gets back to the purpose statement at the time it was adopted and the adaptive management that was supposed to occur. And that is the period of time where I believe we should still try to do what was hoped for in 2013, and that was maintain and enhance both fisheries. And so that, compared to what? Compared to what before this policy initiative started. So that's at least my reaction as to why picking a period before the policy adjustments is appropriate, as opposed to in the middle of them when it was becoming apparent they weren't working out quite so well, or 2018 when the policy's over as a base period, I think would be out of bounds quite as well. So maybe a little bit long-winded there, Commissioner Graybill, but that's why I think that base period is a good one.
Well, Commissioner McIsaac, if you're looking for a reaction from me, I agree. I think, we want to do a kind of apples to apples comparison. And in order to do that, we need to have the same base period. If we were to look at a different base period, first of all, I don't know how you would arrive at such a a base period, it would be largely arbitrary. But in any event, if you were to pick a different base period, you would not be doing apples to apples. You would be doing the apples to oranges comparison. So, I mean, we need some sort of reference period in order to make an evaluation. And so I concur with your response to Mr. McLaughlin's challenge.
I suppose my question would be to our Columbia River managers on staff, if there's a significant difference between choosing the 2013 base period or 2016 to 2018, we're operating under the same rules during all of this period. So I'm not sure what the debate's all about, but perhaps Bill, you might give me some input on the significance of the base period.
Sorry, struggling for the mute key again. Well, obviously, particularly recently, as run sizes are very different, base periods have different inherent run sizes, but although we can always standardize for run size. To me, it's definitely more of a policy choice. Which time periods do you, the commissioners, feel best reflect either the conditions you're trying to measure from or the conditions that you're trying to measure change from, either measuring improvement or measuring change? It's and if you choose a different base period and need us to sort of standardize it for changes in run size, we can certainly do that. But I don't know that we're in a position to provide much guidance relative to the basic policy choice of where you think your either starting point or your reference point is.
All right, Bill, thank you. I'll make one comment, and that is that when the policy was first adopted in 2013 and put forward in 2013, that was during a period of abundance. We saw record returns of every species to the Columbia River during that period, and the allocations that were set and a lot of the assumptions were put in place based on very healthy runs. And I've always felt that due to that basic criteria of healthy returns to the Columbia, that policy was conservative and allocations were appropriate. And although some of the assumptions weren't met, and the promises such as alternative gears weren't met, but the allocations remain appropriate, particularly as we move forward and look at what conditions we're operating under right now. But, you know, pick a date. You know, I'm not sure how significant that is to this process. And, you know, whether you pick it 2013 to 2016 or 2016 to the present, you know, we're still just looking at the basic principles of the document. And so I'd just soon get past this. And I'm not sure what else you've got planned for discussion, Chair, but I don't think we need to spend a lot of time on this.
Okay. No, we've got a lot of other things we can talk about. Maybe I would just restate, I think it was a noble purpose to start with in 2013 to make things better. That's a worthy purpose. I think there was an expectation of some 22% increase in angler trips and some number of hundreds of thousands of dollars better for the commercial fishing industry to happen as a result of that policy once it got implemented. And that was a very worthy and a noble goal. That's trying to make things better. And that's what we should still get back to. Have we made things better or not? And so that's why I get to that base period being appropriate. Well, let's see. Maybe rather than go batch by batch and show all these letters, there are many. There's a lot of emails in there. There's some short ones. There's some long ones. There's from individuals, from organizations. I do want to get to the county commissioner letters, but maybe before then, there was a theme from a lot of the shorter emails and shorter letters that had to do with the conservation benefit of the old plan. And the conservation benefit of not allowing their gillnet fishing at any point in time, or gillnet fishing during the time that's currently allotted, or the amount of gillnet fishing that there used to be before. And so I know that when we get down to whether or not the runs are on a state of decline, that's another theme that was in a lot of the shorter ones, that the runs are all spiraling downward. Some of the letters referred to headed for extinction and things like that. That when we get to the factual matters question from the staff, they'll be updating some of the graphs that we saw earlier in the year, and we'll get to that question of relative status. But in terms of conservation, that's one thing that here at the committee level, we've got a chance to get into a little bit further. What was intended originally for conservation?
And yeah. So,
you know, when we hear a lot of public comments, go back to where you were on conservation. I wonder, you know, whether there should be some discussion about what was really intended for conservation to start with, and what was intended just for allocation.
So Mr. Chair, if I might, I too was struck by that. You know, we received many, many emails, you know, similarly worded, as you say, kind of. Urging the commission not to abandon the conservation objectives that were set out in the original policy. And so, you know, that started me thinking or recalling in this kind of long process, that was one of the key questions that we wanted to have analyzed in the comprehensive review. You know, basically what conservation benefits have occurred as a result of the policy. So, you know, I went back to the comprehensive review and read it and, you know, specifically on that question, and on a couple of occasions it references a document called the Decision Support Document for Columbia River Basin Salmon Management Policy and draft January 12, 2013. And so that document, I had never seen it before. I had a chance, I asked staff to provide it to me, and they did. And I think all the other commissioners on the committee received it as well. And so it gives some really valuable insight toward what really were the conservation objectives for the original policy. And if I may, Mr. Chair, I don't want to prolong this thing or bore other commissioners, but I think I'd like to read a portion of this decision document for the record, and just so that everybody hears it.
Yes, okay. Go ahead.
So I'm looking at, it's under section 11.0, conservation impacts of draft policy, and it's bolded language. And I won't read the whole thing, but here's the important part. So the draft policy is not projected to reduce fishery impacts on wild salmon.
fisheries for all species of salmon in the lower Columbia River are constrained by federal incidental take permits with ESA impacts. With ESA impact limits, and in parens, spring Chinook, sockeye, fall Chinook, coho, and chum, or other conservation objectives, and in parens, summer Chinook. And so it goes on to say, for this reason, the proposed reallocation of catch in the main stem of the Columbia River from the commercial fishery to the recreational fishery is not anticipated to change the combined recreational plus commercial fishery impacts on wild salmon before Bonneville Dam. And, you know, and then later on under fishing mortality, it kind of repeats that. And this is at page 17 under section 11.2, quoting, since fisheries are already managed consistent with conservation and recovery standards, the draft policy is not projected to reduce fishery impacts. Fishery impacts will simply be reallocated from the commercial fishery to the recreational fishery, not reduced. So I think it's important then to put that into context when people say, well, don't abandon the conservation principles of the original policy. The original policy was largely an allocation shift, not necessarily a conservation, not a reduction of impacts, just shifting it from one fishery to the other. The conservation aspect of the policy was limited to the idea of reducing the number of stray hatchery fish by increasing the implementation of alternative gear, which under the theory that we could we could remove hatchery fish and return wild fish. And, you know, I'm not going to go into, you know, the inability to meet that objective with gear. But so I just wanted to make sure that everybody is clearly understands that the original policy, as clearly laid out in the decision document, was mainly looking at allocations of ESA impacts or a reallocation from the commercial to the recreation.
Thanks, Bob, for that. You know, that's nothing new. We've stated many times that we're operating really under ESA impact guidance on the policy. That's nothing new. Again, I'll remind people that we were operating under those principles and should continue to operate under those principles. But what people are objecting to is the expansion of the use of gill nets, particularly in the spring, prior to a run update, post run update on mixed stocks below Bonneville Dam, on spring Chinook that are one of two species that is listed as endangered on the Columbia River, and also in the summer when our summer, where our steelhead to the upper Columbia are also in serious, serious trouble. They believe, I believe it's their perspective, that that would be not provide, but inhibit the ability of the original concept of conservation that did not allow for those fisheries in the first policy. So all of a sudden, we've become not just an allocation policy, but a conservation policy critical to these particular stocks. And I believe that's what people are objecting to is, and you'll hear that time and time again in public comment, is the reintroduction of gill nets to the main stem river. And that's what they're pointing to as a dangerous direction during this period of very low runs and bad ocean conditions and all the things that we've observed since 2015. Now, I know, Dawn, you're probably going to provide us with some graphs and charts that show that historically runs go up and down. But the reality is we have some stocks of serious concern, and the proposed draft document could seriously damage the ability to recover those stocks.
So let me just respond. Thank you, Commissioner Graybill. You know, maybe your reading of the comments is different than my reading of the comments. My recitation of the purpose of the policy or the intent of the policy is just not to rehash things, but rather to respond to the comments. And the bottom line is that we've got a pool of ESA impacts that we need to abide by. And so then the question is how do we use those impacts? There was an attempt to try to use more of the commercial impacts in a selective with purse seines and beach seines. And again, I won't repeat the litany of failures there, but it did not come to be. So just to sum up, I just thought it was important to put this on the record, and it's in response to my reading of many, many comments that have similar language that talk about don't give up on conservation.
Well, thank you, Bob, and I appreciate that. And but again, I'll state that what we're doing now and have since 2013 is the minimum that's required. And I appreciated Commissioner Thornburn's comment on an earlier call during a commission meeting that doing the minimum just isn't working anymore. That's the floor. And I've had many comments from other people that doing the minimum is not accomplishing the goals right now of recovery and conservation, and that we need to re-examine those and consider escapement goals in the upper river and even those hatcheries that are even below Bonneville Dam. So, thank you for pointing that out, Bob, and I'll just remind people that doing the minimum is not getting the job done for recovery and conservation right now. And by expanding the use of gill nets in the main stem below Bonneville Dam, certainly won't contribute to conservation or recovery. I mean, we've heard from the Lower Columbia Salmon Recovery Board. We've heard from the commissioners in Chelan, Douglas, and Okanagan counties. Those commissioners make up the Upper Columbia Salmon Recovery Board, and they were pretty specific, and there's concerns about the increased use of the potential increased use of gill nets in the Columbia River.
Well, maybe a perspective for me. Let me say it's good to hear you, Commissioner Graybill, say that this is nothing new when Commissioner Kehoe says the original objective was not to conserve more fish from fisheries, but rather just to reallocate. And that's how I see the analysis building up to the plan adopted in 2013 and its execution since then, that we're going along with the National Marine Fisheries Service judgment on what a no jeopardy take is, that when you balance it with all the other H's is the appropriate level of take that will not jeopardize the continued existence of the fish. When you say that adding a commercial fishery would seriously impair the ability to recover, that gets a little confusing to me. So let me ask you a little bit more about that. There isn't any adding of fishery intensity takes that I can see in here. So when you add, when you say we're adding a commercial fishery or we're adding a gillnet fishery, this all still abides by the same limit on the take, and there is not any adding of fishing pressure called for in this revised plan language, just like there was not any in the first version. So I'm having trouble figuring out how whether it's allocated to this fishery or that fishery, or you adjust 10 points here or 5 points there or whatever, it makes no difference in the ability to recover unless you want to do something more than what the no jeopardy take allows for already. And if you do want to do more than that, then I think you really have to look at the cause for whatever stocks there are that are in trouble. So, I mean, for example, some of the Upper Columbia Spring Chinook runs are in tougher shape than others. So why is that? When you look at the 4-H's, why is that? Is it because there's been too much take in fisheries and you ought to reduce the take more? I think the take is 2% in non-treaty fisheries. I think when you look hard at why that's the case, you're going to look at that H called hydrosystem, or you might look at the H called habitat, maybe downstream from the tributaries. And so if you really want to do more to conserve the take of fish across the societal takes, looking at the fishery one and trying to reduce that beyond the 2% level is something that's going to take a lot of analysis to show that that's going to bear fruit. But I'll get back to this question for you, Commissioner Graybill. When you say adding commercial fishing, this proposal as it stands now does not add any fishing pressure. So how do you generate that into a conservative take?
I think it's common sense, really, when you consider that what you're talking about in the draft is to add a gillnet fishery below Bonneville Dam prior to the run update, when we don't even know if we're getting an accurate appraisal of the forecast. And then again, to allow a gillnet fishery below Bonneville Dam post run update. But the fact that those nets are going in the river does put increased pressure on the resource. And because those are mixed stocks, there is the potential for doing further damage to the escapement ability of the Upper Columbia spring salmon. I mean, that's just common sense. When you add, say, within the ESA guidelines, still an expanded fishery using gillnets with the attendant bycatch, I am very concerned about the ability to recover, particularly Upper Columbia spring salmon. Also, when we get into the summer run, this draft policy calls for gillnets being allowed in any zone on the summer fish, and that's when our steelhead are moving upstream. And again, those are in serious jeopardy. Not my opinion, but the opinion of NOAA Fisheries. Those are the two fisheries I point to. I'm not, as you well know, and I have made the statement many times, that I do not call for the removal of gillnets from the Columbia River to end commercial fisheries. But what's the appropriate level? And I feel very comfortable with the levels that were put in place in 2013. Given all the failures of the promises and what was anticipated as a result, but to expand the use of gillnets in the main stem Columbia River is a serious step backwards and causes serious concerns for recovery. And many people look at that as contrary to conservation concerns. You know, we're operating under ESA and, you know, some of these other factors, but obviously I don't think that's enough. We're doing the minimum, we can do more.
Yeah, okay, well, this is a good kind of healthy discussion that ought to happen if we're looking at responding to the public comment. If the public comment is you're doing something wrong, we ought to discuss a little bit about why. Let me make one more remark on conservation, and then we can move on to the next one. Commissioner Keogh was reading about the conservation of, seems like there's two phases here. One is conservation in terms of saving fish from fisheries. Conservation, if you're conserving your money, you're saving your money. If you're conserving fish, you're saving fish. You're reducing the take of fish from fisheries. And that the original plan did not call for reducing the take of ESA listed fish. It was just a reallocation of those takes. The other part of conservation that's a little bit more of a nuanced thing is helping the PHAS problems in the tributaries. In other words, removing more hatchery fish from the ability to spawn with wild fish in the tributaries. So because all the fish, including the catch and release mortalities, are counted in fishing, this doesn't result in the take of more of the wild fish when there's a limit on it, but it would help in future generations if there was less of them to interbreed with wild fish. That analytical document that Commissioner Keogh brought up, as I recall, does have estimates of how much selective fishing in the recreational fishery will help on that. And what has happened over the course of the 5 years is not too much. And the biggest fisheries in the fall, and that's not even a mark selective fishery. Well, there's been a couple of weeks when it's been tried, but the mark rates are so low that the public's just very unsatisfied with that. And the plan in 2013, it seems to me, relied heavily on the commercial fishery to reduce the number of hatchery fish. I think the analysis says for below Bonneville anyway, the summer Chinook escaping the lower river fishery would have less than a 1% change in the mark rate as they leave the lower river fishery, just because the intensity of the lower river sport fishery is not strong enough to make much of a difference. And even in the spring Chinook fishery, I think the report said it should be negligible. So it is a little disappointment that the transition from gillnet gear to alternative gear over the course of the past 5 or 8 years has not lived up to the hopes there, and I hope we can do better. But those are the two different kinds of conservation. One is saving fish that was not originally expected, and in this current draft, it is also not expected. This is just an allocation thing. Conserving by the take of more hatchery fish for future spawning interactions, I think that was a goal to start with, and I think the current draft still has that as a goal. So I don't see anything that's much more negative about the alternative gear pursuit in the new language than the old one.
Oh, you're right, Don. The language is appropriate and encourages the continued search for alternative gears. But again, I don't know how you view the expanded use of gill nets with the attended bycatch during the spring serves anyone's purpose in terms of conservation or recovery. I mean, we've had a lot of input on what type of a threat that represents, whether it was recognized in the old policy. But we're going well beyond the parameters that were in the old policy, and I believe need to be maintained if we're going to see a future fishery for not just the stocks I've mentioned, but others. And we're still falling short of escapement goals, even at the hatcheries below Bonneville Dam. And to increase the presence of gillnets in the river down there, I don't know how that's, I don't, can't see that contributing to an improvement in that condition.
But you do acknowledge that all the catches in sport and commercial fisheries include the retained catch and the best estimates of the released catch, and that there is no pattern of exceeding the limits?
I just wanted to point out in the response to some of the public comments, Mr. Twite's email, and one of the things that, that I saw from that is that the staff recommendations for increased fishing were not adjusted with the new information that was available, because there's no direction in the management plan to allow for it. And so, again, that just points to my concern that what's in place now isn't enough, and that we need to be fully conscious of the impacts that we're having on stocks of critical concern. And again, not by my opinion, but from NOAA.
Should all be considered for sure. Okay, well, let's move on, if that's okay, to these letters that were received from the three county commissions on the east side. Let's see if I can find in my notes where I could bring one of those up, and I think it would be good to pay some respect to those county governments that have spent some time sending a letter. Let's see here. It looks like maybe the this one here has one. Let's see. Yes, here's one from Chelan County. We have one from Douglas County, and we have one from Okanagan County that are all very similar. And so I do think it's a good idea to recognize that this is here. Maybe before we discuss it, it would be interesting if there are any of these, I think, nine commissioners that are on the line now that would like to speak to the letter. Nikki, I'm not sure how we would find that out. If we were all in Olympia, we'd look around and say, is there anybody here who wants to raise their hand who's one of these nine commissioners? We do have a hand-raising feature. Nikki, would you go over that little process and then maybe ask the participants if any of them happen to be present before we start discussing this?
Sure. So as a reminder, everyone's currently muted. If you are a county commissioner, the raise hand button appears under your name. And if you're on the phone, please press star 9. Not see anybody, Don.
Okay. Okay. Well, these letters are all similar, and they talk about how much good dedication there's been in habitat improvement efforts up and down the line, and in particular in their areas. And they're looking at contributing all the H's, making a good contribution. And in the one H that has to do with fishing, they've got some recommendations here that I think deserve some, the respect of some discussion. Commissioner Graybill, maybe I'd offer you the chance for any opening remarks since they're from your country about any of this, or if you know anything about this.
I'm not sure what you want from me, Don. I think these are pretty clear. Stating their concerns. As I'll mention earlier, that these county commissioners serve on the board of the Upper Columbia Salmon Recovery Board. They are the board members. And that's where these letters were initiated, was from the Upper Columbia Salmon Recovery Board. I don't know what your intent is here. I think these letters are pretty clear. you know, I see Jim Anderson and Molly Lindvall are on the call. If you wanted a reaction from them, I'm not sure what you want to discuss here. I think the letters are pretty self-explanatory from the perspective of the Upper Columbia Salmon Recovery Board.
Well, there's a couple of things that come to mind when I read these bullets that strike me as, well, maybe not completely accurate. And I wonder, I'm just going to try to interpret what maybe they might have meant. Maybe I'll just make a few comments, and Commissioner Kehoe, you could make some, and then if we would like to call on any of the other two commissioners on this, I guess we could do that. And maybe we could ask the public who's listening when they get to open public comment to speak to it as well. Retaining this, and this is, they're suggesting some things relative to how 3620 ought to be in the future. I'm going to take it that way. So retain the existing ban on non-treaty commercial fishing in the main stem Columbia for spring Chinook. Technically right now there's not an existing ban, but I'm going to presume what they mean here is they're advocating for no commercial fishing on spring Chinook in the future from their perspective. And I don't know if the next bullet says retain the 80-20 split on all run sizes, I guess. What that means for the 20% to the commercial fishery if there's not going to be any in the main stem. So there's the kind of a thing that hits my eye when I read this as not being sure what's intended there. Retain the existing policy that any unused impacts for greater escapement not be shifted to additional commercial fisheries. And I don't know that that is the existing policy that's currently in place. And I think this just refers to spring Chinook. So I don't know that it, concurrently in both states that is the existing policy. Retain the existing policy to not allow fisheries to open until the post run size update is reported. Right now, we do have a significant recreational fishery before the run size is updated, and there is not any existing policy that disallows a tangle net fishery before the run size update. So the word existing here, again, kind of catches my eye. And so I would presume what they mean here is they would prefer there to be recreational or commercial fishing below Bonneville or below the state line until the run size is updated, but I'm not sure about that. Avoid any changes in the main stem summer Chinook fisheries as they could negatively affect Upper Columbia steelhead. So again, this is just referring to the commercial fisheries, I think. But when it says other non-selective fisheries, it's not clear if that means the sport fishery. And at our last meeting, I think we did have staff answer the question, well, how many A-run steelhead are taken in the sport fishery by catch and release mortality? And how many are taken in the commercial fishery by catch and release mortality? And it was an order of magnitude higher, at least an order of magnitude higher in the sport fishery. So I guess I would presume they mean literally what they're saying here, but I have trouble really believing. I don't know if I think they meant close the sport fisheries too. Maintain the current recreational fishery allocations. I think I can understand that part, as decreasing could impact the agency's ability to implement conservation fisheries. And I'm not sure what a conservation fishery is. I presume they might mean that part of conservation that doesn't deal with reductions in take, but rather removal of hatchery fish. I presume that's what they might make. And complete development of the harvest plan. I really like that bullet. I like that bullet a lot. So there's my reaction to it. And again, I want to paid the proper respect to these folks who signed the letter and considered it, and they're trying to put ideas forward to try to make things better. But I'm still not exactly sure what they mean and why. So there's my reaction.
Hey, Don, this is Nikki. Larry wants to say something.
Okay. Chairman Carpenter, welcome.
Can you hear me?
Yes, gotcha.
Oh, no, I just, I was a few minutes late getting on, and I'm listening. I don't have a comment at the present time, but I may. So I just want to let you know I'm here and appreciate your work and listening carefully.
Thank you, Larry, and welcome. Commissioner Anderson or Commissioner Linville, it was suggested that you'd have the opportunity to offer a perspective here on these letters. Would you like to do so?
Commissioner Isaac, this is Commissioner Linville.
Yes, go ahead.
So I guess I just wanted to say that I wouldn't want to interpret what the county commissioners are implying or trying to get at on this. But I sense that it probably, and please know these are my words, not the county commissioner's words. My sense is that they are probably not talking about reducing sport fisheries and only are speaking on the commercial fisheries. But that's just a guess, and that's just an interpretation.
Okay. Thank you.
This is Jim Anderson.
Yes, go ahead, Jim.
Yeah, I was like you. I looked this over and I was not entirely sure where things were at, because it seemed to be a little bit different than I would have expected. I note on the policy about unused impacts, I believe that there is no current policy, and that the shift of unused recreational impacts to the commercial fisheries, I think, would only be based on some analysis that was provided, a very de minimis number of fish expected, maybe in the handful of two or three fish or something. So I if I remember right regarding that aspect of it.
Yeah. Well, maybe Ryan Lothrop, would you like to speak to whether or not that's true about what the current existing policy is on spring Chinook for unused impacts? And I think in the current draft, it says that the flexibility would be available, that the unused impacts could be used for fisheries or escapement. But in terms of our existing policy and the existing policy for Oregon, Ryan, would you like to take a stab at that, or Bill Twight?
Yes, Chair McIsaac, I'm trying to pull up a sheet so I can read. I have it in 1 second. All right, so speaking to unused impacts pertaining to spring Chinook, as I scroll through there, and that would be, and let me clarify the question, of unused recreational impacts to the commercial. Is that the question?
Yes.
So the current status quo for the Washington policy, which was the PRC recommendation, just for a reminder, that was not addressed. So under that, but so For Washington, it was not addressed. For Oregon, it was their existing rule is to the commercial fishery. So there's a difference between the two states, but we're speaking to Washington here, and it has not been addressed.
Okay, thank you. Okay, anything more on these letters from the county commissioners? Well, is there anything else in the aggregate of the written comment before we go to public comment opportunity?
Oh, Don, excuse me. This is Dave. Typically, And again, this is just a question, but and maybe Bill Twight can help on this one, but when we get letters like this from elected officials, are we encouraged to or required to respond in some way? You know, Don, you had some questions about you're trying to interpret the meaning of this letter. Is the onus on us to respond with these questions, or you know, what's the follow up on letters of this nature?
Yeah, well,
That's a good question, Commissioner Graybill. I was thinking the exact same thing. You know, how do we respond? Or glad you brought it up.
I think in the past when we've gotten a letter from elected officials in counties about what the agency ought to be, what the commission ought to be doing and this and that, that we've offered responses the best we can, either by letter or by phone call. This is in response to the open public comment period on this draft. So that if there's a situation where we're responding back to them and engaging in some dialogue that results in some sort of a elongated process before the commission can get to a decision on this, I don't know about that. I think if we start down that road, that list could lead to some delay. We've asked for some public comment. We've got it. And there could be questions about a lot of things. So I guess my reaction is that we've done that in the past on other things. This is a little different in that we're asking for comment on a public review draft that's scheduled for a decision point, originally a decision point at this upcoming meeting in a few days. But now that's been not going to occur, and we're going to schedule it for a little bit later. So there's my reactions.
Mr. Warren, I see your smiling face, or maybe not smiling just yet. Not enough coffee. What's your considered opinion on this?
Yeah, Commissioner Graybill, thank you. I did raise my hand when you guys asked that question. I'd like to address it if I can. As Commissioner McIsaac pointed out, we would consider these no different than testimony before the commission, and we would not be preparing written responses for the commission to review and respond back. We're grateful for county electeds to provide comment, and as we do, the citizens and the constituents of the resource, but when they come in under public comment on a policy or a particular policy matter, we typically only refer to them as comments to the commission, and we do not respond to all of those. So just wanted to share that with commissioners.
Okay. One thing these did not, correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe these were addressed to the chair of the commission and were not submitted under the, ability to provide public comment to the work group website. I don't know if that changes things or not, but these were addressed to the chair of the commission and then distributed to the commission. So it gives it a little bit of a different characteristic.
Commissioner Graybill, I don't disagree with that. However, I think that the point there and the context in which the letters were written were to comment on a policy and a policy matter before the commission. And therefore, I'd continue to think that they were as if we were in a face-to-face comment. Those commissioners may have made an appearance or wanted to supply through the chair to the subgroup of the Columbia River Work Group comments on behalf of those citizens that they represent within their counties and recovery boards. So I think that the intent here is them trying to offer opinions and policy positions based on their locations and constituency and recovery actions relative to the policy review that's going on within the commission.
Okay, that's great, Ron. And they still have the ability during public comment periods that are coming up to also voice their views and maybe offer clarifications.
Absolutely.
So, thank you very much, Ron.
Thank you.
Okay. Is there anything else that caught the eye of any of the work group members in public comment that is worthy of some more elaborate discussion than we can afford at the full commission table? There were two items that did catch my eye or that were themes that more than one person talked about. One of the issues had to do with tangle nets. And we heard from, we have written testimony on both sides of the tangle net question. But when we get to agenda item number 3, there's a question about tangle nets there, and maybe we can save that until we hear some of the facts on that. Let's see, there was some public testimony about the Oregon connection. And I think maybe that might be another one to save till later in the agenda. And I guess from my perspective, lastly, there was in the most recent batch, there was another letter that talked a lot about economics and net economic benefits and questions about the analysis that's available. And there was a lot of analysis done way early on. And Commissioner Carpenter here, back in his earlier days, was on the committee that dealt with a lot of the economics. So there's that backlog of analysis there. And there's all the analysis during the PRC process. And then we went through at this committee, the most recent economics stuff. And it remains maybe an unfortunate fact in the world of economics that there is no direct apples to apples comparison between recreational economics and commercial economics because of the intricacies of, the economic interactions web that's out there on all economic things. Maybe it's due to some of the economic theory points. But while it continues to be a question that often comes up and has for 50 years or more, it remains that the economists don't come up with exact apples to apples trade-off type of thing where you can take a look at that. I think the letter made some good points on net economic benefit and asked, what's the net public benefit? So that gets a little bit away from the net economic benefit that's so difficult to get a handle on, particularly when some of the costs go all the way out to other H's. But in terms of a net public benefit, that was an intriguing question that I thought about again. And it's not just the economics, but the benefit to the public. And so this new draft does talk about trying to do more for the commercial sector than has been able to be accomplished according to the original intent back in 2013. And that is a recognition of the public, in my mind, the public net benefit of having more people than recreational fishery enjoy some of the benefits of salmon. And you've heard me say before that I think the more people that are interested in salmon, the better off the salmon will be. And so whether it's a marine fishery or a freshwater fishery, whether it's a commercial fishery or a sport fishery, whether it's a troll, a herring, sport fishing endeavor, whether there's the tribal fishery connection, the non-tribal fishery connection, the more that you shrink or eliminate some either user groups or the geography of people that can enjoy the benefits of salmon, I think the worse off it's going to be to try to get people to publicly support all the things necessary to make things better for salmon. So that's my perspective at a high level of the net public benefit. So those were my remaining reactions to all this public testimony, written public testimony that we took. So then, why don't we take a look at this open public period and see how many people we have, and if there's not too many, we can do that and make a short break. And a whole bunch, maybe we could take a break now. So, Nikki, what do you show as registrants for public testimony?
Well, it looks like about 10, but we really won't have a good gauge unless I start the conversation and see how many people raise their hands.
What's the wishes of the work group members? Would you prefer to move to that now or take a short break?
Maybe a short break.
Yeah, good. Yeah, I think so. And that'll give Nikki a little opportunity to encourage comment too.
Okay. Well, let's get back together at 9:55. That's a rounded 10-minute break, and we'll start back at that time. When we do start, Nikki, maybe you could give a readout of who we would start with.
Yeah, I can do it right now really quick, too, just to make sure people's hands are up, and then we can go to break. Okay. So if you're on the phone, it's *9, and if it's just regular Zoom, it would be if you hover over your name to raise your hand.
Nikki, could you read off three names there, and we'll start with those three people just so they're alerted. And let me ask you this. If we have anybody who's on a Salmon Recovery Board, I'd like to give them the first opportunity. Is there anybody there who's you recognize from a Salmon Recovery Board?
Well, I've got the first number. I've got last four digits, 6593. Then I've got Greg King, David Moskowitz, and then Robert Sudar.
Well, let's do this. Let's start with Greg King, and then Mr. Moskowitz, and then Mr. Sudar. And when we come back, if there happens to be a Salmon Recovery Board person on the line, and if you could somehow let Nikki know, I'm not sure how we do that, but we can get to them shortly thereafter. But at least these three gentlemen would know they're coming up here at 9:55.
Okay, and we do have four people so far to speak, so.
Oh, good, okay. Thanks very much. Okay, or no?
Yeah.
You can't, okay. Okay, I got dropped off. Did anybody else, was that just me here? Did my terrible internet on Ice Mountain?
I think it was just you.
Okay. Okay. Well, if the other commissioners are ready to go, let's go ahead and re-up our work group meeting and go to public testimony. With that smaller number, I think we can go to 5 minutes for each of the people. Nikki, if you could keep a little tracker on there in case folks go over.
Sure thing.
We'll start with Mr. King, Mr. Moskowitz, and Mr. Sudar, and then see if there's anybody from the Salmon Recovery Board.
Okay, I'll do my little spiel. The first one was 6593. So I'll just have them state their name. So as a reminder, everyone's muted. If you have questions, please raise your hand. If you're on the computer, the raise hand button appears under your name. If you're on the phone, please press *9 and wait to hear you have been unmuted. So our first person is last four, 6593. Please state your name for the record. And make sure to unmute yourself. It says he's talking.
And is this Mr. King?
No, this is 6593. This was the first one to pop up. 6593, I'm going to go ahead and mute you, and then we're going to come back to you and see if we can resolve the technical issues. Oh, unless you're there. Are you there? Okay.
You do now.
So we'll go ahead and move to Greg, and we'll come back to that number after the rest of them. So, Greg, go ahead.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Oh, can you hear me, Nikki?
Yes, I can.
Good morning, Chair Carpenter and workshop commissioners and staff. Thanks for letting me give a testimony this morning. As usual, something new comes up, and we have a letter from Chelan County Commissioners. And I suggest that maybe the Chelan County Commissioners should write a letter to the Columbia River tribes if they're worried about recovery up there. I just got off the phone with my county commissioner, and they haven't wrote a letter, which is Lewis County, and they haven't wrote a letter. And I don't think Pacific, Wakayakum, and Callis County have wrote a letter to the commission on this, but I know what their sentiments would be. Let's produce some fish in this state. Okay. So that being said, let's move on to this public thing that Don was talking about here. The public is entitled to part of the public resource, and that is 90% of the public. 10% of the public are sportsmen, and they're entitled to their 20% other than the allocation. And the allocation is goody is good for me. I'm not a greedy person. I don't think sports should be too greedy, because watch out what you ask for. You might lose out. The public is very important in this process. They pay taxes, and they pay power bills, and they pay for these fish too. And how do they get these fish? Commercial fishermen. And to just end commercial gill netting on the Columbia River because some groups, out-of-state special interest groups, come in and say, well, we need to end this because of X, Y, and Z. It's just not the right thing to do. And I know I have full faith in the Department of Fish and Wildlife and this commission to put conservation first. And NOAA Fisheries is going to put conservation first, too, on ESA. There's a 30% buffer on our spring fisheries. The permits are issued by NOAA Fisheries. How the department chooses to kill these fish is up to the department. Whether it be, this might sound silly, whether it's dynamite or gill net or hook and line or whatever, it's the department's choice, and it's Oregon's choice, too. How are we going to kill these fish? So, and I want to touch on another note here that was getting kind of, it's a sticky subject, and I have many, many guide friends that are good friends, but we're not looking at this. And I heard Commissioner Graybill's comments when I first got on about how great the sockeye fishery is up in the Upper Columbia, okay? And if we're all worried about conservation, why are we letting these guides run 2 and 3 trips on these sockeye up there in the Upper Columbia? This is a very sticky subject for anybody. And I'm sorry if I'm bringing it up. I mean, I think a guy could make a living. I mean, I'm not against the guy making a living. But running 2 and 3 trips a day on these fish is really not very conservative, if you ask me. And okay, conservation at all. So, and we only have to look at Buoy 10. The guides take 33% of the fish at Buoy 10. Now we have a conflict. Who is actually taking more fish? Commercial fishermen or commercial fishing guides? So anyway, that's my public comment today, and thanks.
Thank you, Greg.
Thanks,
any questions? Any questions for Mr. King from commissioners or work group members? Okay, Nikki.
Okay, go ahead, Robert Sudar.
Good morning. Can you hear me okay? Looks like you're nodding. It's Robert Sudar, commercial advisor. I've been listening to all of these meetings. I heard the concerns about the Chelan commissioners, and I certainly respect their opinions and their interests in this, but I'd like to point out that we had a Clatsop County Commissioner involved in the original work group in 2012 who pointed out this was going to be bad for the Astoria area. We had letters from Pacific and Wakayakum counties commissioners that were not happy with this, and they seemed to gain little favor in the original conversation. So I'm sympathetic to what Chelan says, but I think that our lower river commissioners would have a similar pro-policy statement in terms of these revisions. In terms of spring fisheries, typically we would get 1 or 2 days in March and April. If you look back at the records, both pre and the early years of the policy, it's impossible for a managed gillnet fishery 1 day a week to negatively impact these runs. When you consider the other options are the treaty fishery and the recreational fishery, which has 35 to 45 days before the run update. And our catch is sampled completely, or not completely. Our catch is reported, and a high percentage of the catch is sampled after every opening in all fisheries, but especially in the spring. If you look at the joint staff report tables, you'll see that the combined recreational and commercial take on Upper Columbia spring Chinook is very small, very small. And so our fishery is not going to negatively impact that that run if we get a little bit of a fishery back. I mean, for that matter, you could eliminate all the fisheries, recreational and commercial, on the Columbia, and I don't think that would solve the salmon problem on the Columbia. You've been hammering on fisheries for years. Well, that's not a fair way to say it. Fisheries are the one thing that the department has some control over. And clearly, the significant changes that have been happening haven't solved the conservation problem and promoted recovery. And so that's why we have these allowable limits that provide some opportunity for both sport and commercial fishing. In terms of the letters that you get, I did an interview, a radio interview, with a Seattle reporter the other day about local fish and the like. And this person, who works kind of in the environmental area, didn't even know that Fish and Wildlife managed salmon harvest. They thought they managed things like hunting and trout. You know, I mean, the public just doesn't get what you're working with. So that's why it's important that you recognize the role you're playing as commissioners representing the whole public, like Greg King mentioned, the non-fishing public. That's an important thing. It isn't just which of us write in letters about this policy. How does it affect the whole state? That's an important consideration. In terms of the concern over the RCW, I pointed out a newer RCW that came out that mandated maintaining available harvest for commercial fisheries. I haven't heard back whether anybody's looked into that. Maybe your lawyer will make a comment about that later on today. But that came out after the one that Mr. McLaughlin was referring to, and it talks about maintaining commercial harvest availability, and that is certainly not what's been going on the Columbia River. I think the other thing I'd like to point out is that, for one thing, public testimony. I think I heard Ryan say that they were going to cut off public testimony for the commission meeting next week, tomorrow. I would like them to extend that a little bit, if possible. Just leave that gap out of your presentation and give us a few more days to look for some of those. I was kind of waiting to hear what happened today before I contacted some of my people that buy from me. And so I'd like to see that extended till the first part of next week, if possible. And then in terms of the policy, I like the revisions. I think it's in keeping with the original intent and the adaptive management intent. I'm a little concerned that there's no sockeye gear allowed. I don't think that at the current situation that we would gain a sockeye fishery. But looking down the road, if things do get better on the snake, considering these large runs we're getting to the Okanagan, if there could be some opportunity down the line for a commercial sockeye fishery again. It doesn't fit now, but I think there should be something in the policy about maybe the 1% number gets changed, because that came about during a period of much lower sockeye runs. And then the final thing is, I still think it should be a 65-35 fall sharing. As I've said before, we haven't been able to get to 30% in any of these years. And so it's unlikely we get to 30% in the future, if that's what our kind of our goal is. If you raise the goal a little higher to 35, we might get to 30. And then it still gives us some room to harvest in better years. And so I would like to still see that change. And I'm happy with the matrix in the spring and the summer. may not be where I'd put the boundaries, but I appreciate going back to a matrix. I think those are logical things. The concern I have with the low number in the upriver percent, if there's a good Willamette return and a low upriver return, it doesn't give us much opportunity to harvest Willamette fish, which come back earlier. And so those are the some of my comments. I appreciate the opportunity to provide them. If you have any questions, I would be happy to answer them. I forgot to make a note on my last thought, so I guess I'll have to stop there. Thanks.
Thank you, Robert. Any questions from commissioners for Mr. Sudar? I have one relative to your testimony on sockeye. So the current draft has a, I think it's a 70-30 split. I don't have the document in front of me. I think it says somewhere, or at least the record says something about that this would be expected to carry any summer Chinook target fisheries, any incidental impacts in summer Chinook fisheries. So the Columbia River blueback is a small fish. When we get to the run size updates of where the status of stocks are, we're going to see this monstrous run of sockeye this year that's starting to embarrass the Fraser River run, frankly, in terms of magnitude. But
don't mention the Fraser, please, Don.
What about alternative gear for sockeye? Another kind of a beach running fish, and the sport fisheries had great success on the beaches this year, but so are steelhead, and it would involve some needing to have a very minimal catch and release mortality. Do you see any possibilities for alternative gear for sockeye somewhere down the line?
Well, steelhead are still a concern, as you pointed out. You use a seine mesh, it's smaller. The Columbia River sockeye are small fish compared to the Fraser. They're quite a bit smaller, almost half to two-thirds the size. And so and also the river is higher, which makes it harder to use beach seine gear. I'm not optimistic that you could find a way to do that. I guess we did do some testing, and it didn't seem to lend much credence to the likelihood of using alternative gear in the spring or the summer season. But maybe somebody who put some time into it could find something that was more likely. I don't really see that as a good fit. I mean, historically, why did gillnets develop on the Columbia? It's because they fit the species, they fit the runs, they fit the there were a lot of reasons why they were, it wasn't all just political. There were a lot of reasons why gillnets ended up being the best fit on the Columbia. Just like why are seines a good fit in the San Juans? You know, it's for pink salmon. It's because they're better at catching them than gillnets are. And also in terms of the Fraser, remember, this is the small run of the four. It's always been the small cycle on leap years. And so it doesn't look very good this year, but this is never a big year. This is off topic, I know, but for people who are concerned about that, most boats went to Alaska in this cycle because it was never a big year. It was just the dominant Chilco run and no really subdominant years. So it's disappointing to see it this small, but it was never a big year. So.
Well, thank you, Robert, for mentioning the Fraser, because I've been meaning to talk to Bob about this, but seems like, Bob, that your a recent email indicated that, I mean, as Robert indicated, it was an off year, but isn't it coming in at about 10% of forecast?
The last Fraser panel met on Friday, and it's really too early to say much except for the very earliest component of the Fraser run, and that's early Stewart. And, Robert pointed out too that there was a very modest forecast, and the early Stewart component is coming in, maybe a little bit below forecast, but we'll know more about the later components of the run, the early summer and the summer which includes the Chilcoot. We'll know in the next couple weeks better, but Robert is correct. This is the off cycle year, and to compound things, the brood year escapement was very low, so very minimal expectations. But I will say about the Fraser, in many ways, it's similar to the Columbia, in that it can surprise you. If you just have average survival, smolt survival, and you have, decent escapement in the brood year, the stars can align for a very, very good return. And I think that's the case with the Columbia River as well. Just given the amount of there is still, decent habitat throughout the systems for sockeye. It could be better, but even with dams, if you get a decent escapement combined with favorable conditions, you can get some good returns. And that's what always brings fishermen back year after year, is that optimism. So I think that's important to remember when you think about the Columbia River as well, because it's very true on the Fraser, based on my experience on the Fraser panel.
Am I still, in 1971, the first year I worked for a share, we had to build a little dip net to pick humpies out of the boat, out of the net, because it was a pretty good sockeye return, but they thought the humpy return would be below spawning escapement. Ended up coming in around 10 million fish and never had to use those nets. And so, it just like this year for summer Chinook, expected to be 38,000, it's probably going to be closer to 68,000. And sockeye, 50% or more over the salmon are really unpredictable that way. And this is really great news on the Columbia, in my opinion, to see these increases this year above prediction. We'll see if it lasts in the fall.
You're on mute, Don. You're still on mute, Don.
Okay, there we go. Thank you. Okay, thank you. Thank you, Robert. Thank you, Nikki. Nikki, well, who's next?
Let's see, next we've got David Moskowitz. Go ahead, David.
This is David Moskowitz. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you.
Yeah. Oh, that's great. Thank you very much. This is David Moskowitz with the Conservation Angler. Chair Carpenter, Committee Chair McIsaac, members of the working group and staff and other commissioners, appreciate the opportunity to testify today. Really appreciate the diligence with which you are looking at public comments received. And that is oftentimes uncommon and has been somewhat difficult to achieve in the past, but appreciate it here. And we would agree with Robert Sudar's request that the cutoff for your next commission meeting be extended into next week so that more people can consider the work and comments that are delivered today so that more people can comment to the full commission. And so we would agree with Robert on that. As far as I want to talk about processes a little further, we appreciate Washington's push here, but to go back to a little bit of history, it used to be that both commissions were working on this. We had a somewhat of an unfortunate, the timing of some commission changes in Oregon really led to a loss of a lot of institutional memory on this subject. And Oregon has suspended their work on it. And yet Washington is charging ahead. We feel that this is an inappropriate and out of sequence review in pushing this public policy at this time. Not only do you not have Oregon on the same page, but you're also pursuing the hatchery reform policy in Washington, and that is still ongoing and is an important part of this process, especially since some of the recommendations are so focused on increased hatchery production. So that we feel is out of sequence and perhaps inappropriate. We believe that the policy, just looking at allocation, and there was a real clear sense that conservation is not part of this and it wasn't intended to be a part of this policy. And that means that it's really just a one-legged stool, because you're not dealing with conservation, you're not dealing with habitat. And I think that the letter from the Lower Columbia River Fish Recovery Board really highlights that was received earlier in June. There has been some good discussion, and we're talking about, there's a lot of experience on your commission. The fisheries are complex and changing. And we believe that human access to the fish should be more flexible and adaptive as well, just like the fish. And I think we're seeing a lot of resistance to adopting alternative gears. We see a lot of resistance to things like guidebooks or logbooks for guides. Even the commercial fleet is opposed to having observers on board. And that leads to, I think, distrust and mistrust about the level of information that is analyzed by the TAC. And that TAC itself is not a transparent process through USV Oregon. Until there's trust with the mortality rates, I think we're going to continue to have problems coming up with a good policy here. We're dealing with a mixed stock, non-selective fishery in general in the Columbia River. They're trying to get all these fish up into a huge area. And we manage by dates, and I think there's a loss of confidence in the modeling that goes on with the agencies. We always act surprised when the fish come in greater or lower than we predict. The climate change and the ocean productivity has really just undermined the models that the agencies use, and there should be a wholesale review of that process, because we rarely do we come in close to our preseason predictions. And that causes all kinds of problems with prosecuting the fisheries. People gear up because they think it's going to be a big run, and then the run doesn't show up. Or we predict a low run, and then suddenly there's a lot of fish. And then we're trying to manage the abundant fish with the smaller runs. As we've been trying to deal with this summer with the summer Chinook and then sockeye and steelhead.
Hey, David, this is Nikki. You are at time, so if you could wrap up, that would be great.
Okay. Coral refugia needs to be addressed, because the migration of these fish is going to be changed by the water temperatures in the Columbia, and that needs to be part of this. And I'd just like to point out on the sockeye, I will wrap this up. The sockeye returning to the Upper Columbia, largely natural origin. I was working at NOAA back in the 90s when they were proposed for listing. There's about 24,000 returning fish decided not to list. They've rebounded tremendously in the absence of hatcheries and harvest. And now look at the snake. We don't have that kind of change. Both of those populations have to go up and over and back 8 dams. What's the difference there? Why is that happening? And on the Fraser, just to comment on this, the Fraser runs up and up, go up and down. But what's missing from the discussion here is that the steelhead runs of the Fraser and the Thompson have been decimated by the commercial fishing, First Nation and otherwise, in that basin. So let's not hold that up as some great fishery for all species. And I think that's what's missing overall with this. It's We're trying to come up with an allocation policy and we're not addressing the other related factors. And I appreciate the opportunity to testify. I apologize for going over. I appreciate your indulgence and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Moskowitz?
This is Commissioner Kehoe. Chair, Mr. Moskowitz, thank you for your testimony. Mr. Moskowitz did bring up the issue with Oregon and their suspension of the process. I was going to make a comment on that later, but I don't know. I'll defer to you, Chair, whether this is an appropriate time to voice my opinion as far as our process relative to Oregon's process.
Well, thank you, Bob. Let me ask if you could just hold that thought or sure. Jot down your thought until we get to agenda item number 4, because that did come up in written comments as well. And I'd like to finish the public comment and not take up a particular issue there. If you have a question of him about it, but that's a very appropriate topic, but maybe we can save it for number 4 if that's okay.
I think that's why I wanted to ask you. Remind me if I don't speak to that when we get to agenda item 4. So, thank
you. I'll make a note of that. Okay. Well, thank you, Mr. Moskowitz, and thank you for sharing your favorite fly. It looks like over there on the Deschutes. Now that you've exposed it to everybody by on your vest, it's no longer going to be your favorite fly. But. Okay, who's next, Nikki?
Let's see, we're going to try, you have 2 more. We're going to try last 4, 6593 again. Go ahead, you're unmuted, and please state your name for the record.
My name's Jim Wells from Astoria, representing Salmon for All.
Go ahead, we've got you. Yeah, we've got you, go ahead.
Well, good morning. I've been listening to the testimony and to your presentation so far. First of all, I really want to thank you 3 guys. I don't really agree with one of the commissioners most of the time, but I do really respect the time you're putting into this. Our Oregon people aren't being quite as prompt about it, let's say, and doesn't make us very happy. Anyway, thank you guys, and I was going to give you a little select area, since that's the only fishery we've had all year. We've been fishing for 5 months in the select areas. It's been open 5 different areas. We just went over the 4,000 fish level now. That would probably equate to roughly 48,000 pounds. And that's the whole fleet, 5 areas, Tongue Point, Young's Bay, South Channel, Blind Slough, and Napa Slough, with no Washington select areas in the mix. So looking at a 5-year average, 16 through 20, that's after the big years that Commissioner Graybill talked about. We're at 36% on the 5-year average. We have about 4,000 now on a 5-year average. Should have been about 11,000 fish. So not doing very well, and barely over 3,000 fish last year. So that's hardly could be considered a commercial fishery. The state of the wild salmon market's tremendous. Bristol Bay's winding down right now. They've caught 34 to 35 million salmon, and the processors now are offering guys an extra 15 cents a pound if they'll just stay around and scratch fish at the end, even after they've caught that much fish. They want every fish they can get. Our little 48,000 pounds that we've contributed over 5 months is pitiful. So one more comment. Commissioner Graybill commented that we're doing the minimum for conservation. We need to do more. He talked about the spring and summer. I mentioned the run update. I don't see how eliminating the commercial fishery and doing nothing with the unmonitored user group that has 70 to 80% of the impacts on their side of the ledger, leaving them alone with business as usual and eliminating the group with 20 to 30% of the impacts is going to do anything for conservation. Commissioner McIsaac, Commissioner Keogh, you seem to grasp that the conservation is built into this under ESA. Commissioner Graybill doesn't seem to grasp that. So anyway, that's about all I would want to comment. I don't want to take up much of your time, but I thank you guys for all your efforts. I support what you're doing. The only thing I would ask is on that, the spring matrix bracket, on the lower bracket, 87,000 and below, that the commercial share be 25% like it is now. And the reason for that is at 20, there's been quite a few years in the past where our select areas couldn't even operate on 20% of the spring allocation and suffered severe closures, and it really hurt us economically. If we had 25% in that lower bracket, that would certainly help us. So thank you very much, you guys, and Commissioner Graybill included. I really appreciate your time. I don't agree with a lot of what your angle you're taking here, but I do appreciate your involvement in this. So thank you, guys. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Mr. Wells. Any questions for Mr. Wells? Okay, Nikki, it looks like we have two more left. Is that right?
That's correct. Let's see. So our next speaker is last 43920. Please state your name for the record.
It's the dynamic duo, Kent and Irene Martin again. And if you're okay with it, I'll go first and have Kent wind up.
Absolutely.
Okay. My comments are fairly brief. What I see going on with the policy and what we're all trying to do, I think, is attain the goal of better fisheries management. And what I see the reforms that we have so far doing are very positive in that direction. I think the reforms put more tools back in the toolbox. It gives management more flexibility. You've got TangleNet and GillNet back in the box, so to speak, in the toolbox, and usable in ways that they can work best and adapt to best. The policy reforms return one of the planned salmon recovery strategies, which was removal of hatchery surplus by various targeted gillnet fisheries. The reforms also provide more stable, viable commercial fisheries on the Columbia River, which is very much aligns with the department's management responsibilities under various RCWs. On a larger scale, if you like, what the reforms do is encourage and support the kind of strong advocacy for salmon that the commercial fishery has demonstrated for decades, literally a century and a half. Now, implied in all of the harvest policy reforms is that somehow or other, we still need to keep working on alternative gear, and I don't have any arguments with that. But I think we need to re-examine what our sort of dream world was, which we would get to alternative gear with zero mortality. I think it's time to dismiss that notion and figure out we're not going to get perfection. What's going to be good enough? We need to figure out also, and I think one of the things the policy reforms are directing us towards is a renewed look and examination of mortality rates, what those mean, and what the issues really are. The harvest reforms really push the notion of adaptive management, which I think is very good. And we may be looking again as we take a harder look at mortality rates and changes might have to be made with climate change, that getting used to the idea of adaptive management and being more nimble about it than we have been in this policy to date is going to be the path of the future management. So that's basically my testimony, and I'll turn it over to Kent.
Thank you. Any questions for Irene before we go to Kent Martin? Okay, thank you. Go ahead, Kent. Yeah,
thank you. Good morning, commissioners. Kent Martin, commercial fisherman from Skamakaway, Washington. With the adoption of policy 3620, the commission made a number of policy decisions, especially for the commercial fishery. Select areas were supposed to be enhanced with additional fish production. New select areas were supposed to be developed. Alternative gears were supposed to be developed to replace gill nets on the main stem Columbia and brought into production. Most importantly, adaptive management, the ability to alter the policy to achieve these goals, was to make the policy workable by reducing PHAS and keeping the commercial fishery viable, while increasing sport fishing revenue dramatically on the order of 22%, I recall. Needless to say, none of this happened. Sport fishing license sales are at best flat. The PHAS situation has gotten markedly worse, and the agencies are experimenting with tributary weirs in natural spawn areas at very substantial expense, and no new select areas were developed. I'm really proud of our fishermen who made the effort, often with their own money, on the alternative gears. Unfortunately, the cynics and doubters in our midst were correct in their view that the alternative gear scenario was a bait and switch caper. Most of them feel they were lied to when they found they were ultimately only allowed to market low value clipped coho and very low value tules. As I speak, there has still not been an economic analysis of the viability of alternative gears. No harvest goals of what is to be caught, when and where. The WDF and WHAD and Commission had at their fingertips some of the brightest and most innovative minds in the industry. These are fishermen, and I know most of them very well, who would not believe that the state would sacrifice hundreds of thousands of salmonids, millions of dollars in economic value to the Lower Columbia and Washington on the altar of a mindless, all-encompassing sport priority. I doubt that those really good minds with the warehouses full of alternative gear would give so much as give the department the time of day now. That's too bad. So when I hear a commissioner say that the policy has failed because of the lack of implementation, I guess I would be inclined to take a leaf from Commissioner Baker's book and say, I'm not sure what you mean by implementation. It's I'm mystified, quite frankly, and so are they. Finally, one thing that has emerged from all this natural resource travesty, the observers and our insurance liability for that, the statistical strip search, and even harassment. It is that the drift gill net is still about the sharpest tool in the toolbox in terms of target fish harvested for critical stocked impact. We have nothing to hide. And I'm not interested in hearing about comments about bogus science and killing orcas. But anyway, the mechanisms to fix this policy are within the policy itself, and I think they need to be used. Failing that, the state needs to start rethinking the hatchery system. Those industrial folks who have been footing the bill have been thinking in those terms for quite some time now, as has the National Marine Fisheries Service. And I might add on that summer Chinook issue, Commissioner McIsaac, you mentioned an order of magnitude in the difference between A-index steelhead in sport and a large mesh commercial gillnet fishery. I believe the order of magnitude was about 6-1. I was on that phone call and I heard the request, and I believe staff member Ryan Lothrop came up with a mortality of A index steelhead in that large mesh gillnet fishery of somewhere between 14 and 26. And for the sport fishery, you could add 100 onto that. So anyway, pretty substantial, and it's really unfortunate when mentioning the word gillnet becomes synonymous to screaming anthrax because it's not reality. And it's unfortunate. Everybody's going to lose in this if this isn't taken care of. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Kent. Any questions for Mr. Martin? Okay, thank you. Nikki?
All right, our last person is Adrian Tui. Go ahead, Adrian.
All right, can everyone hear me there?
Yep, we can hear you.
Great. Well, yeah, first, thanks so much for holding this meeting. I just want to start by saying you know, I want to compliment Commissioner Graybill and stating that doing the minimum for ESA impacts isn't working. While it remains unclear of whether harvest is the primary driver of BH's impacting salmonid recovery, it probably isn't. But what we do know is that directly causing mortality of wild salmonids affects those populations. And we should consider further reducing those harvest impacts, gaining a better understanding of what those impacts might actually be, and reassessing the validity of that ESA take pool. I do think that's important. And secondly, I just wanted to raise to your attention, and I'm sure you know, I want to raise to your attention the fact that steelhead mortality rates for gillnets currently remain unknown and unstudied. And this suggests that your guidance on ESA impacts could be severely flawed. And I know less about the recreational fishing science. I also believe that's heavily understudied as well. But what I do know is that gillnet release mortality has not been studied in the lower Columbia. There hasn't been a mark recapture study, and there are no release mortality data for the gillnet. So the TAC approved mortality rates are not based on gillnet release mortality science. And I'm sure the representatives from Washington would admit that that's true. So since this policy change will reallocate ESA impacts between fisheries, I'm just saying that I think it could be wise to better understand what the potential impact of this policy change might be on mortality of ESA listed stocks, because currently we honestly have no idea. I heard some of the commissioners say today, you know, stressing the importance of having an apples to apples comparison when you're looking at the effects of different gears, whether it's recreational gear or commercial gear, alternative gear or conventional gear. We need to have apples to apples comparisons. We need to have good data. And it's all compared to what, as Don said earlier. We need a reference for comparison. So I think it's just important as we make policy decisions into the future that we actually know what the data are telling us, what are the release mortality rates, and if we make changes between commercial or recreational or alternative gears or conventional, we need to know what the potential impact of that might be. And a great starting place is looking at all of the gears on an equal playing field, because until we do that, unfortunately, we're flying blind. And so do the commissioners here agree that this major data gap for steelhead mortality needs to be filled? And I encourage the commissioners to encourage this kinds of research, because it is very, very important and essential to achieving this set amount, this pool of ESA impacts that's out there. Are we exceeding that? We don't know. And so, as I said before, do the commissioners here agree that this major data gap needs to be filled?
Okay. Thank you, Adrian. Any questions for Mr. Tui?
Don, this is Larry Carpenter.
Please go ahead.
Adrian, you have had a long history of working, designing, critiquing the pound net in the Columbia River, of which you've done a presentation once, at least once, if not twice, in front of the commission. In past years, I received a request to write a letter on behalf of funding. I didn't get any this year. Could you update us on the status of that project, what the future might look like? Because I found it very, very intriguing. I'd like to know what the future might hold.
Well, Larry, thanks for the question. And we will be continuing with our research here, assuming there is enough support out there and funding to make everything happen. And of course, COVID makes everything more challenging, but we're optimistic we'll do some more coho release mortality studies through a net pen holding methodology as specified by TAC. We're working with representatives from TAC to conduct further mark recapture research because, as they know, this mark recapture data is essential to investigating post-release mortality. And alternative gears, all of these alternative gears have gone through rigorous testing, and clearly that's important to TAC. They represent, understand the need for post-release mortality data. And I just think it's important that we also have release mortality data for eel nets or for recreational methods of fishing. It's just, we need to have data for all the gears. And if you don't have data for through the main gears that are operating year after year, then when you're trying to compare impacts between alternative gears, you have no idea what the potential benefit might be. It could be that each and every year, alternative gears could be providing tons of benefit to these fisheries. A gill net release mortality rate. In fact, we're sidelining these alternative gears that could have enormous benefits. But right now, we just don't know because we don't know what the impact of the conventional gears is.
Well, Adrian, I think that's well stated. And we've heard that same comment from previous folks making public comment on both the sport and the commercial side. Is it possible, I know the last time you did a presentation in front of the commission, it was well received and people learned a lot. Is that something you would consider doing again in the near future?
Of course. Send me an invitation and I'll be there. Always happy to share with anyone.
You have an invitation, but if you need one sent, I'll do that.
Well, thank you very much, Larry.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. And I think that ends our public comment period. And we're ready to move on to agenda item number 3. this is one where we have asked commissioners if they had any factual questions in mind. We wanted to stay away from opinion type things, but in terms of just the facts, and I think we had 3 science questions and then we had 2 legal questions as we mentioned at the very onset of the meeting. So before we start, Nikki, let me say that the internet I'm on is a little bit sketchy here. If I drop off again, I'm going to switch over to a different internet source and try to get back on, but we'll see how it goes here.
Sounds good.
So let's see here. If I can get to this, Ryan, as we move, let's take the science questions and the fish questions first and the legal questions second. Let's see. Do I still have everybody here? Am I off already?
You're still here.
Oh, okay. I kind of lost my screen. So Ryan, you've got 3 questions. The first one had to do with abundance of fish, and I was going to try to bring up the graphs and ask if you had any verbal updates that you could do just to paint a picture here. I'm having a little trouble with my screen here, and I think I'm going to have to quickly try to switch over. So let me ask you to take up the second question first, and maybe if you could read this question, and Commissioner Kehoe, I think you were the one who put this one forward. If you have anything to add to the question, but Ryan, if you could read the question and then give whatever response you have to that, and I'm going to try to get back just as soon as I can here.
So, Chair McIsaac, I believe, and Claire, let's just make sure I have them in the right order. The next question would be, what Columbia River Basin salmon steelhead stocks, including Idaho, are consistently not achieving hatchery escapement goals or exceeding the ESA harvest ceilings? Is that the right set of questions?
I'm sorry, you bleeped out there. So the questions would be, let's see if I can find them here. The first had updating the that you provided to the Fish Committee in February on the status of Columbia River and steelhead runs. The second question has a three-part and had to do with achieving hatchery escapement goals or exceeding the harvest ceilings and what role fisheries had in that. The third component of that, if they were exceeded, what was the role of the lower river non-treaty fisheries in any exceedance? So do you have those, or I could read them specifically if you don't have them?
I do. So the first answer, with regards to the escapement goals or exceeding ESA harvest, I think it's been referenced before. The two states, and in this case we're speaking to Washington, have a very good track record of not exceeding the ESA. I mean, it does happen, and within USV Oregon, there's actually, with the biological opinion, it's treaty and non-treaty combined, but kind of referencing our non-treaty only fisheries, we have a very good track record. We have closed fisheries as needed, but we're obviously well within our ESA limits on almost an annual basis for every stock. And we do make management adjustments as necessary. With regards to exceeding harvest guidelines relative to ESA, for example, I mentioned non-treaty fisheries are combined, so sport and commercial. If one area does exceed, we may have to close both sets of fisheries. And that has been the case recently. We have the ability to make up for as some fisheries occur in other locations further upriver at a later date. But our primary objective is to stay within ESA and then adjust accordingly within our allocation of ESA impacts. So we have a plethora of data. I'd like to just always remind everyone every time I have a chance of joint staff reports providing the ESA impacts and catch expectations estimates from an annual basis. So, I mean, I can walk through each one, but it's gonna, you know, I don't wanna eat up too much time. So if there's any specific ones, I can get to those answers. And so also there's some reference to hatchery escapements. The primary, you know, biological opinion pertains to ESA impacts, but we also try to meet hatchery escapements. And so those are largely met on an annual basis, but there's always a stock there's always a constraining stock, whether it's ESA or a hatchery escapement goal. An example would have been the cowlitz this last 2 years for spring chinook. And so those are cases where we adjusted fisheries preseason actually because we knew the forecast was low. But as you walk through a spring chinook season like this spring or last spring later on in time, the warning signs start happening based on pit tag passage of certain facilities that we react accordingly for the upriver spring chinook basin. So, but if I'm just kind of looking at, the track record is good even on hatchery escapement. I will make one note, it's not purely just about escapement to the rack. There are ways to adjust, get approval through NOAA, or there's already HSRG review that allows for some transferring of eggs or fish from facility to facility to make up some shortages. But also you have fecundity, so that can play catch up. Example, I think last spring, a year ago, Leavenworth Hatchery was able to catch up because they had a lot of females on hand, more than you would expect. So there's a lot of ways to catch up. So the true way you would want to evaluate this would be based on, did we meet our release goals? Not necessarily hatchery escapement goals. And so largely, yes, we do. We do have some shortages, especially you do in new programs getting up and going, such as Chief Joseph Dam is a newer program. So that takes some time to get up and running. But largely, we do meet those goals as I'm looking through the data sets. But smaller facilities are oftentimes more vulnerable. But those smaller facilities also do happen to have some adjustments for egg transfers. So I guess I didn't want to walk through in every single program because it would take a lot of time, but I can take any specific questions and try to answer that. So that was my quick, answer to the question in a high level sense.
Okay, thank you. Commissioner Kehoe, this is your question. Yeah. Are you comfortable with that?
Yeah, no, I'm very comfortable with that. And I thank you, Ryan. I think if we had more time and there was an interest, we could go through, you know, the reams and reams of data and reports that you have. But I mean, and maybe just a little background about the genesis for my question. And it's because it's just, again, a similar refrain that we hear in public comments, how can we make any changes to the policy? Let's stick to it. You're not achieving, you're exceeding your ESA limits. You're not making your hatchery escapement goals, particularly in the Upper Columbia. There needs to be some truthing to these assertions. And so I think you've provided it. And, you know, I mean, it kind of reminds me of you, and it's kind of something that we're hearing in our political discourse today, unfortunately, and that is you keep repeating things, and even if they're not true, then people start to believe that they're true. So that was the genesis for my question. And I don't think we need to go into specific details. Maybe Commissioner Graybill, I know you're often mentioning this as a concern of yours. Perhaps you have specific questions about certain systems or hatcheries that you'd like Ryan to dig in a little bit deeper.
Thanks, Bob. Yeah, I think that I don't disagree that we aren't meeting our ESA obligations. And again, I'll repeat that perhaps these ESA thresholds aren't appropriate anymore, given the conditions of overall as we look at climate change and other issues on the Columbia River. And I do appreciate the fact that the staff has been responsive. And when we actually confirm our forecasts or we hear from hatchery facilities that they're not going to make their egg take, that they do curtail seasons and make adjustments in season to do the best they can to assure that those things happen. But these shortages do exist. Escapement goals for summer run salmon, other than on the Okanagan River, always fall short. We haven't had a steelhead season in the Upper Columbia for 4 years. So to say that this is not a problem, we're performing just great, there's no issues, creates a bad image. I mean, it's not appropriate. I don't think it's accurate. There's too many instances where our fisheries are suffering. It's not just the Upper River, as Ryan pointed out, the Cowlitz has serious problems in the spring, and there are others. So We can't ignore those with a blanket, broad stroke statement that all's well on the Columbia River because we're making our ESA obligations. That continues to be my point. And in spite of, all of the efforts by these recovery boards in investing millions of dollars every year to habitat, unless we get the fish back, there's not much point in that exercise. And that continues to be an issue, not just with the Upper Columbia, but other areas. And, as we move through the process of looking at hatchery reform, Ryan, you talk about egg swaps, surprise, Leavenworth got enough fish. So we're shipping eggs either to Priest Rapids or another hatchery. The advisability of having to do that on a regular basis might be contrary to the goals of our hatchery reform efforts too. So I really appreciate your question, Bob, and appreciate Ryan's answer. And I think that the take-home message that I want to deliver is, things are changing on the Columbia River. And to say that everybody's got their egg take, that everybody's getting their escapement is, it's just not true. And we need to address those, particularly with stocks of primary concern that were pointed out by NOAA.
Okay, let's go on to the other question here. One of the other two questions. I'm going to try the screen share situation here to see if that can bring it up. Let's see what we have here. There. So this is a general question about updating these run sizes. And the reason for this question is that we've had a lot of public testimony about the status of the runs, and some of the testimony that I've got here on my notes that came in included runs that are headed for extinction. The runs will be gone forever. We're on a decline every year is the same downward trend, and some of these kind of things. So this is the report that staff put together, beautiful, nice report, showing some of the key runs here. And I'll just ask Ryan to update some of these to tell us how things are going since then. And recall, this was the point of reference. This is Puget Sound Chinook, and it shows that on these red lines, back in the period here before listing, the red line's somewhat higher than it is nowadays. It's been for wild Chinook down 28% in recent years compared to the earlier years. So the first graph here was Columbia River upriver spring Chinook runs. If I count these right, Ryan, 2015, 16, 17, 18, 19. So the run is over. I just wondered what TAC's current rough estimate is for the run for 2020.
So Chair McIsaac, so as we walk through this, I can give you the answer to most every one of these graphs. So the question here is, what is the USB Oregon TAC run size update for upriver spring Chinook? And looking at my numbers, the forecast was 81,700. The most recent update I have is 79,200. So that's 97% of the forecast. Happened to be quite close within the spring Chinook management period.
Okay, so another point in here, somewhere under 100,000. And gosh, I hadn't heard it's that close. So let me congratulate the forecasters who fully accounted for all the spring Chinook business that goes out in the middle of the Pacific Ocean over several age classes and accurately predicted how they made it past the sea lines in Astoria and all the way to Bonneville Dam and be that accurate. So good job on that. Upper Columbia summer Chinook runs. Again, 16, 17, 18, 19. So this is a matter of what's your current estimate for the run now?
So again, the So the forecast was already referenced earlier, 38,000. The forecast or the run size update through USC Oregon Tech during the summer Chinook management period is 65,000 fish. And just to note, for summer Chinook and sockeye, TAC met this last Monday, so that's the most, or yesterday, so that's the most recent updates.
Okay, so some number up in this area here. And I'll just draw my own personal conclusion in looking at this graph that this does not show a graph that is on the road to extinction. This over here was fairly troubling back in those years, was very troubling in those years. That's not the same pattern that we're seeing here for summer Chinook. That's good news. They're not an ESA listed stock. So in my perspective, that's a good news situation.
Well, so let's, to complete the thought there, Mr. Chair, I think the forecasters don't get a very good grade.
Okay.
Great. Let's back up a little bit. Ryan, you know, what's the 10-year forecast for when we looked at those spring numbers? What's the 10-year average? Is that in there? I don't see that. The average was 188,000 fish. And this year, we came in at 79,000. Just to give everybody a perspective. Let's move down to the summer runs then. Ryan, you know, that was a really welcome surprise that we're seeing that. I didn't, the Upper Columbia science person didn't think we'd see an improvement in the Columbia River summer runs till 2020. So this is a welcome surprise, but I also want to point out that just because the line is not down as drastically as when it falls off the edge here, Don, it's not, we'd see another bump here, but it's not equal to the 10-year average. So to show these graphs and draw the conclusion that all's right with the world, these stocks are rebounding. There's no concern, conservation concerns or recovery concerns. That's just not true.
Yeah, well, this is a good discussion. A lot of this is in the eye of the beholder. And, in terms of drawing a point out there that's way out there, I was drawing it from the point of what we heard in public testimony that some of these runs are headed for extinction. And so I don't want to imply... I don't want to imply that everything is hunky-dory for every run or every population that's out there.
I know you distributed a bunch of graphs earlier that showed the historic returns of the Columbia River since the dams were built. And, you know, just to demonstrate, yeah, they do go up and down, but we're operating under different conditions now. And I'm not convinced that we're all... that these graphs are going to carry us well into the future with robust returns. And I don't know how people can draw that conclusion if they're paying attention to what's going on right now in the Columbia River.
So can I ask Commissioner Graybill a question?
Yeah.
So, you mentioned several times we're operating under different conditions now. So I guess a two-part question is, what are those conditions that you're referring to? And then secondly, what's the reference period that you're referring to then as opposed to now? So in other words, what's the then and what are the conditions?
Well, thank you, Bob. You know, we only have to look back to 2015 and the sockeye returned to the Columbia River. There were 500,000 that entered the Columbia River that year, and less than half of that, only about 200,000, made it to the Upper Columbia due to water temperatures. And as you're aware, we're looking closely at areas on the Columbia River that we refer to as cold water refuges, and we're curtailing fisheries to allow these fish to rest in cold water areas. In Washington, we look at Drano Lake, Wind River, for example. On the Oregon side, the Deschutes has been closed the last couple of years. In the fall, early fall, because of concerns for cold water. That's one. You know, we are on the Upper Columbia Salmon Recovery Board committee, Citizens Advisory Committee that I serve on. We're funding a lot of projects now that are specifically targeted at the recovery of spring Chinook steelhead and also the enhancements and identification of cold water areas so that we can provide more opportunities for these fish to recover when they reach their or get close to their spawning habitat. That's no surprise, Bob, that, you know, the condition that I'll refer to is one of primary concern that's had impact on the ocean and the returns to the Columbia. And then even in the Columbia River itself, we've seen high mortality rates due to water temperatures.
So let me ask you, I'm not familiar with the Columbia river temperatures as much as I am on the Fraser. Very familiar. We have the Fraser panel meets twice a week. We get a lot of data from Environment Canada on water temperatures throughout the watershed. And right now, at least the last information that I had from, Friday, was that the river temperatures throughout the system, this is the Fraser, were at normal, historic normal, or below historic normal. So, and certainly I'm not saying that, we don't have a climate change issue, but what I would maintain, and I think the data clearly states it, is that that varies. You've got variability year to year. So, any event, certainly, and I think this policy too, or the recommended changes that we have, unlike the existing policy, does have a provision for cold water refugia and recognizing the need for that. So, I appreciate, Dave, I appreciate the response and the concerns about water temperatures, both in the marine areas and in river. Certainly a big issue. And I do think that, like I say, my opinion is that the recommended change that we have in this policy does address that issue, whereas the existing policy does not.
I really appreciate that too, Bob. And that's a welcome addition to the policy. Water temperatures are variable, and in this year we are seeing very good temperatures for our returns, but that may change next year. And what we're talking about is putting a policy in place that's supposed to endure for many years. I don't think we want to review the policy every year to make adjustments because of conditions. And so that's why I continue to lobby for a conservative allocation and point out the lack of language that's dedicated to recovery and conservation in the draft document and in the past policy for that matter.
Okay, well, let's go through just the status of the reports here, and maybe some of this is in the eye of the beholder, so if we can kind of keep it short, I think we probably ought to be able to offer perspectives on abundance. Let me also say we're supposed to go till noon while our business is completed, so I do want to go through the agenda, even if it does drag off past noon, which I hope it does not. Columbia River sockeye. So here we go, 16, 17, 18, 19, once again. What's the most recent run size that you have there?
Yes, TAC just updated the run yesterday. And sorry, I don't have in the back of my mind, so I'm just confirming. River mouth run size of 348,000 sockeye. And that is compared to a forecast of 246,000.
Okay. Well, in the terms of the eye of the beholder, for me anyway, coming in 100,000 more than forecast, I'll let Commissioner Kehoe deal with the runs next year if he doesn't like that. But this is a phenomenal return, a phenomenal return. And I took the opportunity to go back to the statistics back to 1938 when Bonneville Dam was built. And this remains the second largest run since then. And I know there were some large fisheries below Bonneville in 1937 and earlier years. I don't know how far back that goes, but in terms of the overall situation for the aggregate run, this is really good news. I have not been tracking the ice harbor counts all the way up to Lower Granite, but this is a spectacular return. And in terms of the overall theme of doom and gloom and headed for extinction, my personal eye of the beholder is that's not holding for Columbia River sockeye. It's a wonderful story.
Well, I don't know that that's ever been in question with the sockeye. They're the most challenging to forecast in that we haven't even had a 10-year average to use as models for these returns. I think Ryan will agree that it's we do the best we can, like with all forecasts, but we've been either surprised delightedly or disappointed by the returns based on our ability to monitor or model this particular run of fish. What I appreciate about, say, this year's return and the conditions that allow them to move upstream is the challenges really begin in the upper Columbia and at the mouth of the Okanagan River in the Brewster Pool. And the Okanagan River, oftentimes at this time of year, is in the mid-70s for water temperature. And so these fish just stop there and remain in the pool. And this year, because that thermal barrier has not been in place, there's very good escapement up the Okanagan River into Canada, where there is a tribal hatchery that has the capacity to release 5 million smolts if they get their broodstock. This year, they're going to get their broodstock, and it's a great thing. And I've always encouraged delayed openings to the recreational fishing to allow escapement across the border into Canada so that we can have consistent returns of sockeye thanks to tribal efforts across the border.
Okay, good. That's good news too. Columbia River Upper summer steelhead returns 2016, 17, 18. So Ryan, how does this shake out in 2019 and what are the forecasts for 2020? Because that run is just kind of starting now.
Yeah, so these are just A and B index fish, not Skamania stock. The total 2019 steelhead run for A and B combined was about 72,500 fish. Of those, A run makes up the majority, just a little over 66,000 fish, and the B run 6,300. Obviously, that's we've had a low blip on our steelhead return, so it's, and the forecast for this year, which has not been updated yet, won't happen until we get into late August, early September, has another low forecast combined of 95,500, and A index is almost just shy of 86,000, and the B is 9,600 fish. So okay. Similar low run size compared to last few years.
Okay, that's on the negative side of things for steelhead, at my eye of the beholder. What do we have next here is fall Chinook runs, 16, 17, 18. So what kind of numbers showed up in 19 and what's the forecast for 2020?
So last year's run size came in at around 376,000 fish, fall Chinook. The forecast for this year is improved. It is 420,500 fish.
Okay, so somewhere in this zone down in here then.
Well, I have a quick question, Don.
Go ahead.
Yeah, so
yes, go
is
ahead.
There any, is there any, this is a question for Ryan. So, you know, you mentioned that the summer run is coming in above forecast, spring coming in around forecast. Is there any a relationship between the summer returns and fall returns? In other words, if you have a good summer return, does that bode well for the fall return? And just throw the forecast kind of out the window.
So my professional opinion is we still want to model and develop forecasts and not be relying on one stock or run to base another stocks on. So they travel to different parts in the ocean. They have a different life history. So all those elements, we want to continue modeling every single stock. And so short answer, there's probably, there is likely some relationship, obviously, you know, smolt migration downriver, environmental variables would have some overlap in the ocean, might be slightly different. So I like to let science lead the way on that one if I can.
And we'll know the answer here in the coming months, any event. So yep. Nature will tell us. Okay.
This is really great to see too, that our fall fish are coming through at good numbers, and who knows, maybe there will be a day when we see those big numbers like over a million fish. Those are fantastic. And also, I want to mention, as we look at these graphs, that I've always supported the fall gillnet fishery. It's always been the most abundant. You know, if there's a way to provide some stability and enhance the commercial fishery on the Columbia River, this is where we can do it. And that's proven over time. And but what I do object to is moving it to all zones, because there are tributaries below that need fall fish. And also, this is when these beam run steelhead are moving upstream. We're down to 9,600 is what you're saying, Ryan, is forecast. And you know, that could become a real constraining stock in the future if we continue to not respond to the needs on the Snake River, particular to beam run steelhead. And I think you'll hear that from our staff in Region 1 too. So that's where I'm on that one. Thanks.
Okay, yeah, and this is an aggregate of several fall Chinook stocks, some of which do go all the way up to Alaska where the summer Chinook go and some that don't. So here is a little bit of a breakdown on the two bigger ones. Ryan, what would these blue and dark gray graphs look like for 19 and 20?
Yes, so LRH, or your Lower River Hatchery Tule Chinook. And so looking at my numbers, just to confirm, last year we had a return of just shy of 49,000 fish. This year's forecast is very similar, 50,200 for the Tules. And then the URBs, or Upriver Brights, that primarily spawn in the Hanford Reach, but also are part of the stock that goes into Idaho and the Snake River. Last year's return came in above 200,000 fish, which is great. It came in at 212,000 fish. And this year's forecast is further improved to 227,600.
Okay, so Upriver Bright returns moving upward for 2 years in a row. That's good news. The LRH stock is, those numbers are still down here, but there's been some hatchery reductions, and that is a hatchery stock, so maybe that makes sense. Here's one of great interest to a lot of folks, Wild Snake River fall Chinook, 2017-18. So what's happening over in this zone over here?
So yeah, so this is part of the upriver bright component, but this is the ESA component within the Snake River. Last year's run size came in at just barely over 15,000 fish. And then this year's forecast is just shy of 11,000.
Okay, so in this area in here.
You know, this was a great success story. We had a presentation to the commission when we last met in Lewiston, Clarkston area, and we had about eight people that represented different agencies that worked on the recovery of the wild Chinook or fall Chinook on the Snake River. And they were really celebrating in that I think they had hit close to 50,000 that year. And so this is a stock that's, thanks to the efforts of a lot of different agencies, is on the rebound. And one that we can probably learn a lot from how they accomplished that. And when we look at, say, hatchery reform, you know, how they went about doing that, because it was very dependent on the contributions of hatcheries to get that Chinook run back to a level where we see, you know, over 35,000 in 19, you can see the graph where we saw some really dramatic recovery, good rebuilding, and it's one for that I think we should look at more closely in terms of how they accomplished that and what we can learn for other stocks of concern.
Good, good. One more. How are the coho doing?
So for coho, we had a really high forecast last year. It did not come to fruition. And so the total coho run, and I believe this is to the Columbia River mouth, was 210,100 fish. Of those, most are early stock, 141,000, and the late would have been about 69,000. So a low run size. This year's forecast is to the river mouth, again, this is not ocean abundance, is 140,100. Early stock are 103 and later 37,000.
Okay.
And I don't know why these have been such a challenge in recent years, Ryan. I congratulate you guys for all of what you're doing with your modeling, and disappointing. And I don't know if we can attribute that to ocean conditions or poor releases. I'm not sure, but you know, it's one we need to watch. And also, I wanted to mention that there are, as we saw the Yakima tribe's presentation at a recent commission meeting, they're making a lot of efforts to recover coho in the upper Columbia River. And we'd sure like to see a cautious approach when we're seeing these low returns, and hopefully we can take good care of these fish as they enter the Columbia, and we can help the tribe expand this fishery and get even more fish in the system that we can all take advantage of.
So Chair McIsaac, if I may answer a question real quick.
Please go ahead.
Yeah, so for coho, due to the life history, most return after a complete year cycle in the ocean. And we correlate that based on the jack returns from the ocean. They're very susceptible to ocean environmental conditions, feast or famine, kind of like pink salmon in some regards. So with that in mind, the 2019 forecast was built upon a very large jack return. And basically our hypothesis is the warm ocean conditions, warm blob, we lost an age class after they survived that jack year, that first initial return to the ocean or out in the ocean to survive, and the adults didn't make it to the the age component that primarily returns the Columbia River that we're fishing on. So just wanted to clarify that one part. And they are resilient. They do respond to good conditions when the ocean does set up.
Okay. Well, thank you, Ryan, for all that. Let's get back to the agenda here, if I can find it. And we had one other scientific question before we get to the legal question. So the question here, I had to do with tangle net fisheries, which we got some public comment on both sides, written public comment. And the question is, what are the catch and release mortality estimates for spring Chinook in the recreational fishery and the tangle net fishery? This is the spring Chinook recreational fishery and the spring Chinook tangle net fishery. And do they both have sea lion mortality components?
So Chair McIsaac, I'll speak to recreational first and then tangle net. So recreation, they agreed TAC mortality rate is 10% for both salmon and steelhead. This is based on literature review and does not include a pinniped mortality additive component. However, I will note that there was a study in the Willamette Spring Chinook that came up with a rate around 12%. So it's similar to the 10% that TAC agreed to. For tangle net, they agreed Chinook, spring Chinook rate is 14.7% and 18.5% for steelhead. When fishing, that does include the live capture release certifications, some soak time regulations, and a recovery box. The study that occurred using pit tag analysis, which had and was approved by TAC, did find evidence of about 2% of that 14.7 did have pinniped marks. And so I can try to answer any further questions you may have, but it's, so I'll stop there for a second.
Okay. Any questions of Ryan on the tangle net business? I have one question that's related. We just heard some talk about the gillnet catch and release mortality, not having any study basis or any of that. And if you don't have an answer off the top of your head, maybe this would be something for the commission meeting next week. But that seemed a little strange to me that we would not have any scientific data over the years on that. And what is the number that is used right now for a gillnet? And does that have any scientific study basis behind it?
So I'm pulling it up right now, so I'll get you the rates in 1 second. But prior to the updated rates that TAC agreed to, it was based on observation data agreed to by TAC, some older sets of years fished. So in 2017, there was a observation efforts, and that was used by TAC to evaluate and update the release mortality rate. So I'm just trying to sort and filter. So bear with me 1 second. Get to the right run. And for clarity, we're speaking to the fall run, the fall fishery. So there's two rates, and this is for steelhead. For the 9-inch mesh, the rate on steelhead is 38.3% that is currently being used, and the rate on the 8-inch mesh is 44.8% on steelhead.
Okay. Any questions from commissioners on this?
No, that's enlightening. I really appreciate that update on those and confirmation of what we kind of suspected. I will mention that I do, I got a chart, and this was from a science review from the Upper Columbia Salmon Recovery Board, that shows mortality rates. And what's interesting about it is for different species, but also different times of year. And as we know, as water temperatures rise and we move later into the seasons, the impact rates of catch and releases go up. And I'll be sure to share that with everyone, and you can compare that with what's known. Thank you.
Okay, maybe in the interest of time, let's go ahead to these legal questions that were there, and maybe we can save any other follow-ups to the fish questions for the next time around. So as we talked about at the beginning of the meeting, we had two questions on legal matters. One had to do with a letter from Mr. McLaughlin on the purpose statement. And the other one was a question from
Don. You're going to move past the spring salmon issue?
Go ahead. Or wait. Yeah, go ahead. Is that Commissioner?
Yeah, this is Dave. And while I've got Ryan's attention here, you know, there's been some exchanges since the draft policy and maybe some confusion. And what I wanted to ask Ryan, there was some back and forth between the Snake River Recovery Board and what was recommended in the draft policy as in terms of accommodating the Snake River questions. And Ryan, can you confirm with me from what I read in your most recent emails was that there's two options that are being considered in a sub-option A and sub-option B. The difference is a shift in allocation below Bonneville and above Bonneville. And I'm not sure if you can explain that, but the other confusion was that the shift in allocation would come out of the recreational allocation, Don, and not the commercial. We wanted to be clear on that. And Ryan, do you believe what's currently in place in the draft policy, although it's kind of difficult to tease it out, but I believe that does accomplish what we were trying to do for the Snake River recovery people by moving some fish upriver, spring salmon particularly, to the Snake River Basin?
Go ahead.
So a couple points in there. So thank you, Commissioner Graybill. It's a good question. And yes, I did have a conversation with Snake River Recovery Board, and that was pertaining to primarily to the analysis on the work group's recommendation and what that results in. And so just for a reminder for everyone, the spring Chinook abundance-based approach adjusts the recreational commercial allocation based on run size. The recreational allocation remains the same under all run sizes. And so you would, so the data would point to run sizes that could occur, that the Snake River catch balance and is correlated to catch and fishing effort would be relatively similar. And the only changes would be, and that's because the medium run size, which occurs the most often, is the 70-30 allocation sport commercial, which is the current Washington policy. So I may have answered part of your question there. The other part, I believe, was in reference to older alternatives under consideration by the PRC. And that was 4A and 4B. And those were looking at a 70-30 sharing and two different approaches within the sport fishery only. So it was moving fish from the below Bonneville fishery to just the Snake. I believe that was 4A, and 4B was moving some 5% allocation, I believe it was, to both the zone 6 fishery as well as the Snake River fishery. So those were about 70-30 allocation. That's So that would be different than the current work group's recommendation of 75-25. So I don't know if I answered the question, but it was at least a background response. So please fill in the blanks if I needed to speak more to this specific question.
Thank you very much, Ryan. And if am I correct in saying that the 4B option would accomplish the needs for the Snake River people?
Good question. I don't want to speak for the fishing constituents up in the Snake River Basin on what they feel is fair. Right. But it would move more fish under all, the 4B option would have moved fish under all run size options into the Snake, and the 4B also into the Zone 6 mainstem Columbia above Bonneville too. So both areas would see a form of an increase in ESA impacts and catch balance.
All right, okay. So 4B, it looks to be the best option to accomplish those goals. All right, thank you.
You're welcome.
Okay. Well, is Joe Panesco available to speak?
Yes.
Joe, are you there?
Yep. Yeah.
Okay. So you've heard us outline the question earlier in the meeting, and I think the commissioners all understand this matter that related to the purpose statement. So if you've had a chance to take a look at that, do you have any comments that the work group ought to consider?
We have two matters. We have the McLaughlin letter and then the question from Commissioner Kehoe. Which one would you like me to tackle first?
Let's take them in that very same order.
Okay. So as to the constituent letter from Mr. McLaughlin, he raises concerns over the fact that the language in the purpose statement of the draft policy contains subtle but material deviations, to quote from his letter, from the statutory language. And that observation is correct. The statutory mandate 7704012 has a number of paragraphs and sentences addressing various aspects of the agency's mandate. And the purpose paragraph doesn't quote the entirety of the statute. It attempts to condense it and summarize it for purposes of brevity. And in doing so, you know, some of the language gets changed. But to the extent that Mr. McLaughlin suggests that the language is deviating from the statutory mandate, I disagree that the purpose language necessarily deviates from the statutory mandate. I think there are some ambiguities that are created by the paraphrasing of the statutory language, but it's ultimately up to the commission itself to define what it means by that language, and the rest of the language in the policy can address that and spell that out with more clarity. So I don't see any express conflicts. Another aspect of the letter that was touched on previously, which does have a legal component, is he raised the concern that the statutory mandate contains no doesn't say anything about a benchmark time period, and that again is correct. The statute doesn't say anything about a benchmark time period, but nothing in the statute precludes the commission from coming up for policy purpose to define a benchmark time period that the commission wishes to refer to implement the policy and to carry out the statutory mandate. The commission has clear legal authority to interpret the mandate and provide additional elements on top of it, so long as they are not inconsistent with the statutory purposes. So I don't see any conflicts there. Could the language be more clear as to the commission's intent of, does the commission intend to fully adhere to the statutory mandate language? Well, of course, the commission's job is to carry out the law, and there's no indication that it intends to deviate from that. So the language could be cleaned up some to, or modified some to more expressly state that, and to more expressly call out components like the reference to geography and explain more clearly what the commission means by the geographic component as an additional overlay in interpreting and applying the statutory mandate. So that's the concludes my comment as to Mr. McLaughlin's letter.
Okay, why don't you go ahead and answer Commissioner Keogh's letter, and then we'll come back to the work group for discussion.
Sure, and the question from Commissioner Keogh was whether any of the draft purpose statement was inconsistent with the statutory mandate or the Court of Appeals decision in Puget Sound Crab Association versus Washington, which is reported at 174 Washington App 572. It's a 2013 decision. And it's the same answer as I just provided as to Mr. McLaughlin's letter. No, there's no language in the purpose statement that is necessarily or expressly inconsistent with the statutory mandate or any language in the Puget Sound Crab Association decision. Again, there are some ambiguities in how the language from the statutory mandate has been summarized and pushed together. There's a little bit of conflation between the two different sentences, and it's not entirely clear on its face what the commission's intent was in conflating some of those terms. But the necessary, you know, none of the language necessarily points to a position that is inconsistent with the statutory mandate or the case law.
Okay. Well, comments from the work group members, and thank you, Mr. Panesco, for taking a look at this and offering now that legal perspective. Commissioner Keogh or Commissioner Graybill, any discussion?
I think Joe answered my question very well. You know, just one comment though is that the draft language is not from the commission. This is just what this work group has cobbled together so far. So
right, I don't want to be presumptuous. Right. Yeah, I mean, yeah. It, ultimately, if it were adopted, it would be the commission's position. So I was thinking prospectively. Thank yes.
Thank you.
Thank you, Joe. And thank you for taking the time. I know you got a full plate for looking at this. And I think that, as Bob mentioned, this isn't the official commission position right now. And we could maybe Chair McIsaac, if we want to look at that language and make a few minor adjustments to make it more clear. As Joe has suggested, we have the ability to do that, but I'm very satisfied with Joe's perspective on this. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. And I'll share that same perspective. I think that some of the comments here about ambiguities and could be modified, particularly with regard to the geographic stability phrasing that is not in the RCW. I think it might be good for the work group to think a little bit about that. It's not appropriate today to entertain language changes. This meeting next week is to take public comment, to hear all the public comment, and to schedule final action. And so, however, I guess if I would presume for a moment that final action is scheduled for September, that it might offer some time to do some thinking about some sort of language changes here in this particular area. That's my reaction at the moment, anyway. So.
And Commissioner McIsaac, if I could add one more thing to tie it back to statements I made at a prior committee meeting. Apologies to Commissioner Keogh about one misstatement I made previously. We were talking in part about, commission policy and is it binding? Does it create legal risks if there are places where the department departs from it? And I was misremembering my own case that I argued, the Puget Sound Harvesters Association versus Fish and Wildlife from 2014. I was thinking that case involved a commission policy that set management goals for the Puget Sound fall chum fishery. And one of the previous cases had held that the department didn't comply with that policy and thus invalidated fishing regulations. I went back and researched that further and reminded myself it wasn't actually a commission policy that was at play. It was just a department policy. But the legal risk is still there, because in the earlier Puget Sound Harvesters case, the department articulated a management goal for that particular fishery, and then the court found that the department did not abide by that management goal and thus was arbitrary and capricious in making the particular fishing regulation for that year. And then when I litigated it, the court found that the department had abided by the department's own management goal, and therefore the rule was upheld. So there is a distinction. It wasn't commission policy, but the bottom line principle of the legal risk still remains from those cases.
Apology accepted, Counselor, but I'm not going to let you get off as easy as that. When this when the bars reopen again, I would like a beer. So
I but you've got a while
before
that.
The bars open again, but I'm not going to forget it. So thank you.
Okay. Well, so that's agenda item number three. I'm looking at the clock here, and we said until our business is done, we may only have one or very little in terms of recommendations here, but we do have some more things. And I've got a note here that's been passed to me that there was one individual during public testimony who either had his hand raised up or something or other, and was interested in testifying, and it got met, somehow muddled up in the business. Let me ask Nikki, is that person around? And if we take that public testimony now before we go to agenda item number four, maybe that might be appropriate. Nikki?
Yeah, Brian is still there, and I can go ahead and allow him to talk.
Okay, let's go ahead and do that, and then we'll move through the balance of our agenda after that.
Go ahead, Brian.
And can you hear me?
We can hear you.
Thank you very much. I want to thank the work group for allowing me to testify here today. And I also I want to thank you very sincerely for the attention that you have given to my comments, especially my last comment, which the letter that you had Mr. Pinesco, I believe it is, address. Just one thing I wanted to add on that. The primary purpose of that letter was to focus on policy, not the legal aspect of whether it was in conflict with the statute. And I believe I pointed that out at the last time I testified orally, that whether or not it is in conflict with the statute, I don't think it is appropriate from a policy perspective, because it does change, in my view, materially what is in the statute. For instance, the statute doesn't say anything about enhancing the commercial fishery. And so from a policy perspective, I think deviating in the way you have in the purpose statement does favor the commercial fishery in a way that I don't think is in the best interest of the public. So it's more of a policy issue that I brought up and less of a statutory conflict issue. I also wanted to briefly touch upon, there was some discussion earlier about this baseline and my comments about including a baseline in the policy. I want to make clear, my argument is that I don't think that there should be any baseline at all, whether it's to 2017 or 2010 or 1990. I don't care what it is. The past is the past. I think you should be putting in place the best policy you can going forward. You have done a very comprehensive review of your policy. Now, I have some critiques of that review, but it's been a very long and arduous process. You are amending the purpose statement. You are amending the guiding principles. So I think, given that this is not just, you know, trying to see how you can adjust tactics and strategies to meet the previous goals, I think that you should look at this as a major policy revision and put in place the best policy going forward. And that, in my view, would entail, you know, consistent with your statutory mandate, you know, optimizing public benefits from the combined commercial and recreational fishery. So I don't, again, I'm arguing that there shouldn't be a baseline at all. You should be trying to move forward in the best manner that you can. Regarding the issue about conservation, I haven't focused that too much, but I did want to bring up a couple points. My understanding, especially with summer Chinook, is that the recreational fishery in the lower Columbia has been a marked selective fishery because managers, and I will refer you to Bill Twite on this because this is who I heard this from, Managers believe that the sport fishery has enough power that with a marked selective fishery, we can have an impact on the percent of hatchery fish on the spawning grounds. And so that marked selective fishery has a conservation element. Of course, if you open it up for a gillnet fishery, you know, to whatever extent you allow the gillnet fishery to operate, gillnet fisheries do not operate in a marked selective manner, and you would lose whatever conservation benefit that marginal allocation to the gillnet fishery would entail. But again, I'd suggest you ask Mr. Twight about that. Let me see, I'm just looking through my notes here real quick. I submitted written comments for this meeting. I think Commissioner McIsaac, you alluded to them when you talked about public benefits. And my comments basically suggested that the work group produce some kind of concise but thorough statement. And I provided some questions that I thought you should address to outline why you're proposing and why you're recommending what you recommend. This has been a long process. There's been analysis done by staff on the performance of the prior policy, and of course that wasn't looking forward. There's also been analysis and data looking forward to what the different options are under consideration. But for most people, unless they've attended all these different meetings and listened in and can sort through so much data and so much analysis out there, they don't have a concise explanatory statement about why you're recommending what you're recommending. And I think it would be very helpful to the public and to the commission as a whole to have that out there. And it would certainly help to me to clarify my statements to the commission that I'm trying to draft up as we speak. And I think it would be aid in the transparency of the process. So I would I put forth some questions that I think you should answer. Again, a lot of them have to do with public benefits. And I will say this, I don't think your analysis is sufficient in that manner. There is ways to look at public benefits, especially economic benefits that you haven't looked at that are out there. And I would encourage you to reconsider how you're looking at this. At very minimum, you should be able to, and the department should be able to, put together the cost, the public cost, direct cost to the department of the commercial fishery, management, enforcement, enhancement, research, et cetera, and compare that to what the commercial fishery pays in license fees and fish taxes and that. So you get a feel for, you know, if there is a subsidy to the commercial fishing and what it is. I think that would be very appropriate in this situation because I don't see any data out there that really takes a look at whether the commercial fishery is in the public interest as far as public benefits at all. And I'd encourage you to look at that. And I think there's data out there that you could put together that that would speak to that. So I just encourage you to look at the letter, the last letter I put together, the questions that I outlined there, and to really consider putting together a concise but thorough statement about why you're doing what you're doing. And I will point out this, you did so with respect to the adaptive management provisions, and I'll probably have some comments on that, but I do appreciate, I think it was Commissioner Kehoe put that together, and I just appreciate that kind of effort to explain your rationale for what you're doing. The last comment I would point out is that if you'll recall after the last decision the commission made, I think it was in it's a while back now, but it was in March of 2019, was it? The director put out a statement after that decision explaining the rationale for it. Now, I've criticized that statement because I think there were some inaccurate parts of it, but I note that the director needed to put out that explanatory statement to explain why you were doing what you were doing. In this case, I think you would be serving the public interest and also the commission if you were to put out that beforehand so that we could have a statement, we could all be kind of working off the same page. So anyway,
Brian,
I do appreciate again.
You are at time, just so you know.
Okay, I was just wrapping up. I do appreciate the opportunity to comment. And again, thank you very much for the serious consideration you have given my comments. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Next on our agenda is other considerations. And so we have written down there to remind us to look at Commissioner Kehoe has to do with the Oregon connection. So do you want to start with that?
Yeah, thank you. Mr. Chair. So, you know, recall Mr. Moskowitz brought up the fact that Oregon has decided not to join Washington in the collaborative approach in reviewing and the policy and coming up with draft changes for both commissions. So, and on that basis, his opinion was is that this commission was out of order. I will say that that's not an opinion only expressed by Mr. Moskowitz, but we've heard that from some other public testimony, and in fact, maybe a commissioner or two on our commission. But here's my response to those who say that. First of all, right now, Washington and Oregon are not concurrent. Washington adopted the recommendations of the PRC, the Oregon and Washington PRC. We adopted those in March, I believe, of 2019. Oregon did not take any action on the recommendations. And then as was pointed out, then they had some commission changes. So, so right now, I mean, we are non-concurrent. And then secondly, as opposed to, you know, doing nothing, I personally am not in favor of delegating these policy decisions to our director. This is a job for the commission. And it seems to me that if we were simply just to drop the ball and to abdicate our responsibilities as a commission to develop policy, that's a wrong thing to do. Otherwise, why? I mean, we would just, and I realize this is controversial, you know, if that were the case, then the commission might be in a position just to say, well, this is a too hot of a potato. We're going to delegate this to the director. That's why we have a commission to make these policy decisions. And then thirdly, you know, assuming we do come to finality, assuming there are some changes, then when we are in a position then to tell Oregon in a nice way, these are our positions after a long, protracted public process. This is what our commission has come up with. We want you to consider it and work with us toward getting concurrency. If we can't get concurrency, that's not the end of it. There are obviously, that's it's not the ideal situation, but there are ways for us to implement non-concurrent regulations. Again, not the preference, but so those are my reasons, Mr. Chair, I think, and my response to those who say that our process is out of order without Oregon. So thank you.
Thank you. Thank go ahead, you. Commissioner Grayville.
Thank you very much, Bob, for your comments. I agree wholeheartedly that this commission should not be delegating the authority to our directors. It is our responsibility to put policy in place and then have the department execute it. In terms of concurrency, which is where we've had delegation. That was in the early stages when we were meeting with Oregon. I think even the title page was to arrive at concurrency with the state of Oregon. That was a goal of this process. And particularly since the absence of Oregon's participation, we've moved further and further and further away from any form of concurrency with Oregon's current policy that is in place by rule. And not saying that they can't change it, but it's a more difficult process. And that we must realize that before we can present them with anything, but we should anticipate some cooperation from the Oregon side of the river in agreement with this policy. And I think we need to be prepared for further discussion on this in an effort to reach concurrency. And so ultimately the final filter is going to be with Oregon. And I would encourage, I believe there's a meeting on August 11th with participants on the Oregon side on this policy issue. And I would be very much interested in learning what comes from that meeting. But we have some challenges ahead of us. And I most emphatically agree with Commissioner Kehoe that we need to stop delegating the policy to our directors and take the responsibility of making those decisions one way or the other. Thank you.
Thank you for that. And let me chime in and add my support to not delegating to our director. This is the kind of tough policy choice that is a commission decision. And so, you know, on the matter of concurrency, when this started, we weren't on the original policy. I think zones 4 and 5 for a commercial fishery were to be removed from the main stem. Or if it wasn't that in one state or the other, we had some non-concurrencies that had to be dealt with when we met jointly with the commission in November of 2018. And the hope was to get this all solved in early 2019. And so in, as Commissioner Kehoe said, in March of 2019, our commission voted. We thought Oregon was gonna vote shortly thereafter. It had some things to do with north of Falcon and just kind of completing it before their big turnover. Unfortunately, that didn't happen. So we were non-concurrent before, we're non-concurrent now, and we need to try to move toward getting concurrent. And so the first step in that is, what do we believe should be our policy perspective when we sit down, which I'm sure ultimately we will, with the state of Oregon and talk to them about concurrency. They had a good reason for suspending. They had a complete turnover, not a complete turnover, but a substantial turnover in their commissioners. They had a brand new chair. And you know, I don't fault them for wanting to suspend their activity. But with regard to their old policy, I'll call it the old policy, they have a statutory obligation that's could be considered even more stringent than ours with regard to what to do in cases like this. My main point here is we need to figure out what we want first. When we sit down with them, if we still don't know what we even want, then where do the negotiations go but muddle around? And so that's why I had been hoping that we'd be voting on our position here next week. But we're not going to do that. So we're going to finish the public comment period. We're going to think about it and try to get to a position. I hope that happens in September, and we'll get to any recommendation here in a moment. If we do get to that, I agree with Commissioner Kehoe that we ought to politely engage Oregon. If they've started to pick up the pace here on August 11th or whenever and try to become more knowledgeable about the whole business, which was their reason for stepping away, that's a great sign. And so we ought to invite them back to the table, and we ought to cite our long history between Washington and Oregon about reasonably getting together and problem solving these things and looking at joint state scientific assessments and a thorough discussion of things and get to a point where we can get to agreement on all these important policy measures, several of which we have picked up at their initiative back in the PRC arena. Some brought up by their prior chair, Mike Finley, and some by their staff even. So I think we can probably get there. If it turns out that by the end of 2020, we still don't have a joint agreement with the state of Oregon, then I think we could look at what to do in 2021 based on the forecasts, and but continue to move on. And I think we've got a long history with Oregon on problem solving that can get there. But we have to get to our spot first. And so that's why I do think it's time to fish or cut bait on these important policy questions. So long-winded agreeing with a lot of what you all just said. Let me meld together agenda items 5 and 6, future process and schedule and recommendations. You know, the commission is only going to take public testimony for our report, and they're not going to make any policy decisions at this meeting. They're going to decide how to get to finality. And so I think it might be good for this commission to recommend that we do schedule a final action on this matter for the September commission meeting. And if that's the case, then I think the committee probably ought to meet again just before that to consider some of these minor language changes or whatever comes out of the discussion next Friday. There may be some more things that, having heard public testimony, some ideas come out. And I had been asked by somebody, is this the last CRW meeting? And if we were voting next Friday, it would be. But we're not going to be in that situation. So it could be that there's one more. We'll have to wait until Friday to see. But I guess looking at the clock here in particular, I'd like to ask the two other work group commissioners what they felt about a recommendation to the commission next Friday to reach a conclusion and bring this to a vote for final action, consideration of final action at the September commission meeting.
Yeah, so I'll go first, if that's okay, Dave. I mean, I agree. So just to be clear, then the recommendation would be, coming from this work group, at the commission meeting next week, would be to recommend to the full commission that we schedule the Columbia River matter for final action at the September 10th and 11th commission meeting. Is that, do I have the dates right? So just to 10, be clear, 11
and 12.
11 and 12. So that would be, and I think that lines up with what Commissioner or Chair McIsaac said. So I'm prepared to make that recommendation, and just and I'll turn it over to Dave.
As much as I'd like to draw this work group to a close, there are some things that came up today. There may be some minor language changes that as the work group members would feel more comfortable as presenting to the commission for final consideration. I don't see any drastic, so substantive changes that we would make between now and then, but there are some minor issues. I would also like to be able to include if there's any input from the Oregon Commission prior to that meeting. And so, I agree with Bob, we probably need to have one more get together just to collaboratively agree on language. But substantively, I think I don't see it going forward to the commission in much different form than it's in now. So that's me.
Okay. Well, based on that, then, if you do feel comfortable with that, then we'd present as our work group report the recommendation that the commission schedule final action on this for the September 10th to the 12th meeting, and maybe on September 10th, which was the day before the commission meets, that we convene this work group again to consider any relevant language changes that the work group wants to entertain. I do think that's a good idea to
Mr. Chair. That. Sorry, this is Bill Twight.
Yes, go ahead, Bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. September is really problematic for staff. I'm not sure how much work, how much staff work there will be to pull the package together for a final by the commission, but just recall that we're absolutely in the thick of our fall fishery management in September. And there'll be very little bandwidth, staff bandwidth, for the last 2 weeks in August and the first 2 weeks in September.
Okay, well, let's look at this review of staff assignments and see what that might be. I did not have a feeling like there was going to be many staff assignments. So I'm going to imagine that in September, if this went forward, the notice of the public would say the staff will brief the commission on the status of, at this next meeting, the staff will be briefing the commission on public testimony, and we're supposed to, quote, sleep on it until the next meeting. So with that regard, until there's another work group meeting that recommends anything different or any discussion like that on the floor on Friday, I guess I don't see a staff assignment coming forward. Let me ask the other commissioners if they see a staff assignment that we would ask them to do between now and then, and what the expectation would be at the September meeting, other than presenting the draft report, and I don't know what else.
Go ahead, Dave. You go first.
Well, actually, you know, the only thing that I might want to put forward, that I'm not sure if we need analysis or not, Bob and Don, but is to put this sub-option 4B in the draft and replace what's there now, which only reflects a status quo on this the Snake River allotment. And I want to make sure I'm stating that properly, but in my notes here, I believe what Ryan told us today is that would best serve that option and move fish into zone 6 and to the Snake River Basin. And we may want to consider putting that option in the draft to replace what's currently there. And that's the only assignment that I could think of, is if you fellow members would like to have some kind of analysis to justify that change.
Well, he was referring to the analysis that's on the table now when he responded. So I think we've had, I think the analysis is there now is sufficient for that consideration,
I agree with that. You know, unless Dave, you want to tease out more. I don't, and I appreciate the follow-up work on that. I think it is useful. It was a little bit different what we heard today than what we've heard in the past, but I don't envision more staff analysis for that. And I will also, and let me say too, I'm very sensitive to staff time. I know in my professional responsibility, I'm very protective of my staff and very conscious about workloads. But, you know, I don't envision more staff analysis here. I don't know. I don't think there'd be much work necessarily in terms of prepping this for the commission other than, you know, for final action, other than kind of summarizing. I mean, we'll have the draft language presumably ready for review. So, and then I think the other thing to consider too, as far as staff time, is we won't have the travel burden. I can't imagine that, I know these meetings are gonna be Zoom or virtual meetings.
We don't have to have Ryan, you know, get in his car and drive up, or you, you know, or anybody drive up from to take away from your compact responsibilities. So, and I throw that out for Bill and Ron's reaction now.
And I might add one other thing, that this process has a lot larger body of written record to it over the course of all the meetings, which are posted here on the website, than the previous exercise. The previous exercise did have decision documents and things like that at the time of decision that brought together a variety of material that was not widely publicly available prior to that point in time. So I would be comfortable with this recommendation for September, and including in it next Friday an expectation for low staff workload, and be particular about that. There's a meeting summary document that's needed that does not need to be the whole ball of wax, again, because the body of the written material that's already on the website and available.
Well, I am in agreement too. And Bob, I really appreciate your consideration on the Snake River. That seems to be something we can tackle. You're right, the analysis has been done. I think there's just some basic confusion as we arrived at that decision earlier. And thank you for considering that. And that's something we could do that requires no more staff time. I believe that what we're looking at is some wordsmithing to become more comfortable with some of the language in terms of how it compares with statute. Very minor things. And I really do respect the time that the staff has dedicated to this process. I don't think we need to demand any more.
Let me go back to Mr. Twite and Bill. Having heard that, I respect the fact that you're defending the staff like you are. It is a busy work period, but there is a real policy benefit to bringing this to a close in the very near term. So if there is an expectation explicitly expressed to reduce the staff burden, do you have any response that you'd like to put on the table for us?
Oh, thanks, Mr. Chair. I was just flagging that if there were, that staff's bandwidth to produce much of anything is pretty low. If indeed it's, as you've just outlined, there's not any analysis, it'll still be a little problematic for staff to even help with pulling together basic presentation. But if we can work to minimize that, we certainly had it on our calendars. We just we will be able to provide limited assistance. And if that works for all of you, we certainly don't want to be dictating your schedule.
Okay. Thank you. Well, let's, if there's an objection, then let's put forward the recommendation next Friday that we do recommend the commission consider final action at the September 10 to 12 meeting. My screen now says your internet connection is unstable, which has flashed a couple of times. Can you still hear me now?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. And that as part of that, that on September 10th, we have a Columbia River work group meeting. And as part of that, that we specify that the expectation for staff analysis between now and then and at the meeting is minimal and should recognize the commitments of in-season management of the same staff. Okay, 7B on the agenda is closing remarks. Anything from the work group members? Okay, well, let me say thank you again to everybody. Thanks in particular to the staff who continues to do an excellent job supporting all this. And we'll move this forward and have another discussion next Friday in front of the full commission.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Dave, and thank you, staff and the public.
Thank you.
And Joe Panesco.
And Joe, yep. And
you owe me a beer.
Thanks very much. Adios.